This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You're listening to the longest running, weekly, episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
Our traveling fanboys. When you hear this show, you better run for cover.
Klondike Bill's a sausage lover. Ooh, our traveling fanboys.
It's a weekly podcast, and you better listen.
They keep your ears in mint condition.
Place to Be Nation Pop, welcome to a very, 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 very special edition of Off the Page here with the Hard Traveling Fanboys in luxurious Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, in our L-shaped studio with our L-shaped table. I am Greg Phillips. With me, as always, in our studio here, where we are indeed in the same place every week, is Nick Duke. Nick, hello.
Hi. Why so many varies this week? I mean, not that it isn't a special edition, but I don't know that it's that special compared to most of our other off the pages.
How many varies would have been appropriate?
I don't know. Less than five, probably, though.
Less than five, but more than two?
I don't even know that more than two would have been appropriate.
Well, I'm trying to give the
if we're talking about how special a particular edition of Off the Page, that would have applied better, I think, to our previous Off the Page where we reviewed the DC Comics deck building game because it was a very, 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 very unique situation.
Well, that's different. A unique situation and a special edition are not necessarily the same things.
What's so special about this edition? What is going to make it different than any other off the page we've ever done, Greg?
I'll tell you what's going to make it different is that we're dedicating it to the memory of a certain deceased individual. We're dedicating it to the memory, in all seriousness, folks, of the legendary Rowdy Roddy Piper. Because tonight or today, whenever you're listening to this podcast, we are delving into the Green Lantern Emerald Knights movie.
Uh-huh.
This is a DC Universe animated movie, and this is a movie that came out way back in 2011. And this stars Mr. Piper, one of the great professional wrestlers of all time, one of the great characters of modern pop culture, as a pretty famous character in the Green Lantern lore, but a deep cut character, one that Green Lantern fans will know, but others may not, known as Bolfunga the Unrelenting. So for those of you who regularly listen to the show, which is going to be most of you probably out there that are listening to this one, you know that Nick and I are big wrestling fans, always have been, always will be, and continue to litter our show with references. And Hot Rod Rowdy Roddy Piper, one of the biggest stars in the wrestling industry during the 80s and 90s, also did his share of movies. Famously, They Live with John Carpenter is probably his most famous role, and just managed to turn himself into a piece of American pop culture. And Nick, I know that you have a lot of memories of Roddy Piper growing up, as do I.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, whether it was his mid-80s to early 90s participation in the WWF or his later appearances in WCW, yeah, lots of childhood memories tied to the Hot Rod.
Yes, and in addition to being a, as I mentioned, a prolific wrestler, an actor, and all that other stuff, Piper in his later years started to do a lot more outside the box projects, such as stand up comedy, podcasts, things of that nature. And the reason that we're doing this show is it's been almost to the date 2 years since Rowdy Roddy Piper unfortunately passed away. He died July 31st, 2015. And so we decided to honor him by celebrating one of his rare crossovers into the world of comics with this 2011 direct-to-video DC animated feature, Green Lantern Emerald Knights. This was released to kind of take advantage of what was expected to be Green Lantern fever that was going to sweep the nation as the theatrical film was about to come out just around the corner, and or may have already come out at that point. It was right around the same time the theatrical film got released. And so they released this with the thought that people would love the movie and then go out and want to buy anything Green Lantern related. Unfortunately, as we know, things did not turn out that way, as the theatrical film turned out to be somewhat of a disaster. I think that's fair to say. I don't think that's hyperbole. Do you, Nick?
No. No, I do not.
And thus, the Emerald Knights movie was put out and kind of came and went and didn't get a lot of talk, didn't get a lot of discussion. And still to this day, it's not one of the DC animated movies that you hear a whole lot about. Even though, according to a chart that I'm looking at, it sold over $3 million in DVDs and over $2 million in Blu-rays during the course of its release. It still never quite made the lasting impression that some of the more famous DC animated movies did. When you think about Dark Knight Returns, the adaptation, The Killing Joke, even for all of its controversies, the couple of Justice League reunion movies they did, Crisis on Two Earths, and what was the other one, Nick? They brought the cast of Justice League back together and they fought Vandal Savage and the Legion of Doom.
Was it just Doom? Justice League Doom?
Justice League Doom. Yep. Boom. Those are kind of the ones, and of course Batman Under the Red Hood, that you kind of hear referenced a lot. And this one kind of flies under the radar, even though many would say that it was better than the movie that came before it. There's been two Green Lantern animated movies. The first one was First Flight, and that's the one that kind of most people talk about and most people remember. Ugh. But it's really not the better of the two movies, and it's not in my opinion, it's not the achievement that this movie is in terms of really capturing the spirit of what Green Lantern can be.
Yeah, I completely agree. I know this is not at all a podcast about Green Lantern First Flight, but I have some major issues with that one that better left unsaid. But yeah, if you're comparing this to First Flight, I think this is my preferred Green Lantern animated film by a wide, wide margin.
Yeah, and the other thing that makes this different and than prior DC animated films, and even than DC animated films that came after this, is it's structured in an interesting way in that there is a central combining narrative, but in between that are many stories that don't necessarily tie into the narrative. So it's almost like an anthology movie that is kind of threaded together in the course of a bigger plot over top of it. But the main plot is really not the draw here. It's the mini stories. And that's kind of what makes this a unique feature in the DC pantheon, or really the Marvel pantheon, or any animated pantheon. I can't remember a comic book film kind of taking this approach.
The only other one, and it doesn't have a larger narrative tying it together, is Batman Gotham Knight. That one came out around the same time as The Dark Knight was released theatrically, and it had an anthology approach as well, but without the larger narrative tying the anthology stories together.
Right. And so with all that being said, we do dedicate this episode to Rowdy Roddy Piper, all of his fans out there. Hopefully some of you might join us and listen to us talk about this movie. But what we like to do with Off the Page is we take a copy of the movie, whether you're streaming it, whether you're DVD, whether you're Blu-ray, whatever your way of watching it is, and we like to put it on in the background and kind of not do it as a director's commentary or anything like that, but we just want to have the movie going to kind of refresh us on things and keep us moving. And we like to invite the audience to watch along with us as we discuss it. And so I've got my movie queued up to 0000. Nick, I'm sure you've got yours queued up to that as well.
Yep.
We invite all of you, if you need to pause us for a second, please do so and go and grab your copy of the movie if you have it. Or unfortunately, I don't know of it being available streaming anywhere, but if you can find it, certainly go ahead and get it queued up. And if you're resuming us now, then you are welcome to hit play in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, play. And here you see a really cool, just to start the movie out, this really cool logo, this Warner Premiere with the green font. I really dug this, Nick.
Yeah, cool logo.
And the glowing DC logo, which I think, unfortunately,
I like this
was in the movie as well.
Yeah. But that's still – it's still a cool thing.
It's cool, yeah.
I like the effects on these a little bit better with the back glow of the green and whatnot. But, yeah.
Yeah, and so we're starting right out with the main plot of the film, I guess you would say, even though I would argue it's really not the primary draw of the movie. But the main plot of the film starts out here as we get a random Green Lantern flying towards a giant sun and complaining to Kilowog through a ring about, you know, what's going on around her. Suddenly there is an onslaught of shadow demons that come out of the sun from the antimatter universe, and you see a glimpse of a face through this hole that will end up being revealed as one of the Green Lantern's oldest villains, Krona, the Mad Guardian, who is the primary villain of this piece. As his shadow demons, you see that they mean business. They're basically vaporizing this poor Lantern as she tries to fight back. But you're going to see her literally get disintegrated, which I thought was pretty violent for a DC animated film.
Yeah, they had Gotham Knight that had kind of pushed the boundary a little bit, and I think they had kind of made the decision to start marketing them more in that PG-13 direction pretty aggressively around this era. And so, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the violence was just a little bit of a representation of that decision to start shooting for that slightly elevated age range.
Yeah, this here we see a really cool title sequence. I mean, it just looks gorgeous. The coloring in this film is, to use a lack of a better term, is phenomenal. The greens just pop off the screen, especially how they kind of juxtapose it with the black. And this the overall plot is one that was written. The story was come up with by Jeff Johns and Alan Burnett. It was scripted, I believe, by Alan Burnett and Todd Casey. And that kind of revolves around this growing threat from Krona, who's coming in from the antimatter universe, as the Guardians reveal through dialogue in just a moment here that Krona created the antimatter universe years ago and was eventually dispersed in the form of energy throughout the cosmos and somehow reconstituted himself in the antimatter universe and is now coming back for revenge. He's coming back through the sun that is closest to Oa, and that's put all of Oa at risk. And so the Guardians are getting ready to evacuate Oa, which is causing something of a panic in the core. The interesting thing in this part of the movie is our viewpoint character, if you will. It's almost an X-Men approach to Green Lantern. I think that's a good way to describe this movie, because much like Chris Claremont's X-Men had Kitty Pryde as the viewpoint character, much like the animated series had Jubilee as the viewpoint character, and much like the movies had Rogue as the viewpoint character, Arisia, actually, who I know is a longtime favorite of yours, Nick, is the viewpoint character in this movie, as Hal Jordan kind of tries to take her under not his wang, but take her under his wing.
Well, depending on what era of the comics you're trying to be accurate to, taking her under his wing wouldn't have been that far out of character.
Well, that's true. They have a long and storied history in the comic book universe, and Hal certainly does tend to share some characteristics with our friend Jeremy Reynolds. At times.
Wow! Wow!
But no, it's interesting because that that viewpoint character is something you really don't see a lot in Green Lantern books, I feel like. But it really works. To me, it works to – if you're a newcomer, if you're just now – if you don't know much about the Green Lanterns at all and you're kind of trying to understand what the concept is, it kind of helps to have that character that's in the same shoes as you that hasn't heard all these classic stories that you're going to hear throughout the course of this movie.
Yeah, I would agree. The interesting thing here is that they're definitely portraying Aresia as both visually appearing young and also being sort of emotionally and mentally young, which was not how she was typically portrayed in the comics. The deal was always that her species just aged at a different rate than everybody else, and thus, you know, she was the equivalent of an Earth adult both emotionally and mentally, but just appeared to be a young teenage girl. So interesting that they chose to give her a more – to sync up her personality with her appearance a little bit more in this adaptation.
Absolutely. And she is actually voiced in this one by Elizabeth Moss. One of the things that I really appreciate about this movie is we're getting a glimpse of all these Green Lanterns as they're standing in line to charge their batteries and charge their rings through the central battery, which is about to be moved off of Oa. But I really appreciate that we get a Green Lantern Corps with Sinestro very much a part of it, not plotting against it, and almost seemingly instilled as the leader of the Corps. I love that. Nick, what did you think about that decision?
Oh, I loved it as well. Something that I think both Green Lantern First Flight and the Green Lantern theatrical movie could have learned from, and something that also, Greg, the Green Lantern animated series that we both loved so much took its cues from. So, you know, I'm just saying, two Green Lantern adaptations that have been better received than the others are the ones that have followed that approach, and the ones that have kind of fallen by the wayside, I would argue, are the ones that didn't follow that approach. So here's fingers crossed that we get a little bit of that in Green Lantern Corps.
And so the way that this is set up is Aresia, as she's trying to learn the ropes of the Green Lantern Corps, is being told these stories by Hal Jordan. He's telling her these tales of the Green Lantern Corps, if you will. A little comic book reference there. And the first one that we start out with is actually an original story for the movie, as I understand it. This one is written by Michael Green, and who has comic book cred for writing Supergirl and other things, and Mark Guggenheim, who is the head honcho behind Arrow on the CW, which started the entire CW DC Arrowverse, if you will. And this is really interesting because this is telling the story of the first Lantern, and not the first Lantern that we know from the comics that came later as the first Lantern in general, but the first Green Lantern, who is known as Avra. This was an original story, Nick, but I really enjoyed this. It's a story about perseverance, one of those classic Tales of the Green Lantern Corps stories that you would find about a scribe named Avra.
And it has the Dominators in it, right?
The Dominators, yep. We see glimpses of the Dominators as the primary villains in this particular story, although I don't think they're named in this. It's clearly the Dominators. They're drawn to be the Dominators, and it's a nice little nod to the comics. Right now we see the Guardians forging the original rings, and I also love the kind of almost religious subtext of this where Hal's reading it, reciting it, and they refer to the Book of Oa several times in this movie as scripture. And Hal is reciting this almost like the Book of Genesis of how the Lantern Corps was born and how it came to be.
Yeah, that's a nice touch. You know, the Book of Oa is a concept in the comics that has always kind of been kind of vague and ambiguous. You know, some people who write Green Lantern have it, you know, more like you said, as a religious text, and other people just kind of have it as a historical record. Then other people like Geoff Johns have introduced, you know, the prophecy aspects of it. So it's always interesting to see how each Green Lantern writer deals with the book, and here, what with Geoff Johns working on it, they kind of combine aspects of the like you said, the early scripture elements with some of those Geoff Johns prophecy elements as well.
Yeah, and this story is really cool because it's showing like the rings are going out to choose their first lanterns, and they're going after like you know, physically imposing creatures that seem to have some kind of combat experience, and then the last one chooses this scribe who's just a writer. He's frail and weak and, you know, doesn't really have any kind of physical intimidation factor about him whatsoever. We also see a little bit about how the rings change in look over the years, because the rings you see here look different than the rings you see the regular Lanterns wearing in present day. really enjoyed this aspect of it. And it's kind of a, you know, one of those stories that I wouldn't have mind seeing brought into the comics, because it's so, to me, it was so compelling and it was so inspiring of this character who, against all odds, when everybody else is ready to give up because they're overpowered by the Dominators, this character comes up with the foresight to create the first construct. And that's really what this is about, is the guy that first came up with the idea, the creativity, to create a construct that helps them defeat the Dominators, which would change the course of the Lantern Corps forever. Yeah,
I mean, I agree with you that I would like to see this particular character probably moved over into the comics, but I will say that right now in the pages of Green Lanterns, we're getting Sam Humphrey's kind of telling his version of the early days of the Corps in flashback form, and he is kind of giving it a concept of the first seven Lanterns, the original seven, and they're playing a role in the story right now. So I don't believe Avra is one of them, but interested to see how that plays out in the comics that are going on current day.
Yeah, and one of the things that that I think this movie does, and it's hard for me to say objectively and for you as well, Nick, because we both came into this movie already Green Lantern fans, but one of the things that I feel like it does is, to me, it does one of the best jobs of any of the adaptations of really showing you all of the different aspects of the Green Lantern Corps that make it cool, that make it unique, and showing you a little bit of the kind of themes you can expect from the comic stories. They're tales of inspiration. They're tales of unlikely heroes. I mean, how many times in Green Lantern books have we read stories about the least likely individual ending up being the one that saves the day? You know, I think back to the Sinestro Corps War and Buzz, of course, our buddy Buzz, and, you know, characters like Gnort and or Nort and characters like Chip, unlikely, weird, crazy alien creatures that pop up and save the day when it's least expected. I think you get a lot of that throughout the course of this movie, of kind of showing people what they can expect if they dive into Green Lantern, because I really do think it's the richest mythology in the DC universe, and one that should appeal to anyone that's interested in the fantasy side of comics.
Yeah, absolutely. Hard to say how this plays to people who aren't, you know, longtime Lantern fans. You know, you and I both kind of geeked out over it a little bit, getting to see some, you know, there are a couple of these stories that they have in this that are pretty much, for the most part anyway, straight adaptations of some of the more famous Green Lantern short stories. And then, of course, you have stories like these that are a little bit more original creations. And so with this one, it's kind of you and I get to kind of go through the lens of a new viewer, whereas with some of the other ones, we're kind of leaning upon our longtime fandom that kind of colors our perception of at least a good portion of this film, I would say.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, to me, watching this again, this is the first time I've watched it in a few years, I think, probably about two or three years. And I was just struck by how much I was enjoying it. I started watching it last night before we recorded this podcast, and I was so absorbed into it. It was almost hard to stop it and go to sleep, because I was enthralled, and I'm awestruck when there's something Green Lantern related that is so good. And this, to me, is about as good as it gets for getting across the concepts that make this awesome. So each one of these little shorts is written by a different team and directed by a different individual. I believe this one, if I'm not mistaken, this one is directed by Christopher Berkeley. And later on, we'll see shorts that are directed by Lauren Montgomery and Jay Oliva, both of whom have done great work for DC animation over the years. Jay Oliva has kind of become their new go-to director, but Lauren Montgomery, I believe, was the director of Wonder Woman, the animated film, and she's also directed maybe Justice League Doom and a few other ones, and done a great job of it, by the way. Oh, she did Superman Batman Apocalypse, Justice League Crisis on Two Earths. So both her and Jay Oliva are – they're tremendous at what they do. And honestly, Christopher Berkeley does a hell of a job with this one. The action here is good. The facial expressions are pretty humorous.
Such as they are, anyway. This purple character doesn't really have much of a face, so.
No, that orange character had a bit of what I would call a JR expression on his face of Maul.
Maul.
Oh, he's going to die. That's what he's going to do. He's going to save the universe. He's going to die is what he's going to do, for God's sake. But yeah, so we see –
he also has Anderson. Balls on his head when they do a close-up of his face.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does. Bruce Timm produced this, and this is one of the last of the movies that was done in that traditional Bruce Timm style, I would say. Even though it's not, you know, it's much more evolved from what you saw back in the 90s.
Yeah, it kind of has some anime-like elements thrown into the anime, I would say. Elements.
But it's got a smoothness to it, to the motions and the activities that, you know, I don't want to belabor this because I feel like I bring it up every time we talk about DC animation, but I feel like it's kind of not the same anymore in the new animated movies. And I just something about this style just appeals to me more. I think it's smoother. I think it's, for lack of a better term, more of the traditional Americanized style mixed with some Japanese influence. It's not that choppy kind of movement style.
Yeah, this whole thing going on with Avar right now attacking the ships is very anime inspired. You can tell. Has a little bit of a Dragon Ball Z quality to it.
Yeah, yeah, splitting the ship in half and creating this giant sword construct that he's driving through. The explosions all look great on this too. Like I thought about that earlier. The explosions in this movie are quite impressive. And here you see somebody taking his lead and deciding to create their own construct. Admittedly, a much cooler construct. Some kind of four-way drill. Which, you know, hey, if you can find a four-way drill, there's a lot you can do with that.
What is the utility of this four-way drill? I mean, wouldn't she just, you know, she could only use one of them at a given point, so why do you need the other three points?
Well, you would think, maybe the thought was that if another ship came nearby, you might be able to do a little extra damage to it. You know, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Sometimes, I guess it's kind of like, you know, you ever drive by one of those semi-trucks on the road and they have those the things sticking out of the wheels that seem to be almost so far that they're almost seem to be intent to do damage to vehicles that come alongside them.
Yes, I'm aware of what you speak of.
Maybe it's the same concept.
Maybe it is.
So we get to see how to explain how these Green Lanterns evolved over the years. And the implication that you get here at the end of this is that the ring that went to Abin Sur is the same ring that began with this first lantern of Avra.
Mm-hmm.
And as those who aren't aware, Abin Sur eventually is the one that dies and gives his ring to the greatest of all the Green Lanterns, Hal Jordan.
And will play a key role in a future one of the anthology stories we're going to talk about here in a little bit.
Yes, he will. Now, the second story that we're going to see in just a minute, we're going to go back to the Oa home world, and it's going to have another kind of transition as they continue to prepare for the battle to upcome against against Krona. We're going to move on to
upcome. Interesting.
Upcome, come up. You know, hey, if you're welcome to take over leading this ship anytime you want to, Nick.
No, I'm fine. I'm riding passenger, just sitting here watching you swerve and try not to hit things.
Well, no, I can wait. We'll wait to hear Nick Duke's genius ability to captain the ship. You ever wonder if Paul's nostrils get sore after a while?
You ever wonder if Paul Feinbaum ever considered an alternate career as a 1980s WWF wrestler?
Oh, man. Grab them cakes. Oh, man.
Oh, he could have used Don't Go Messing with a Country Boy. Country Boy. Country Boy, and then we would have had terrible overdubs every time he made an appearance on the WWE Network.
Well, you know, it's possible that Hillbilly Jim is the guy that sings the Call Paul, He'll Make Sense of It All song.
Oh, God, the Call Paul song. We are way off topic, but is that not one of the worst compositions in musical history?
He'll make sense of it all. Trying to get the grit in the voice, you know? Good stuff.
No, it's really not, though.
nevertheless, here we get our first adaptation to this point in the movie, and there are several of these in the course of the film. This is one of the best. This is
perhaps the best. I would argue personally. This
was actually an adaptation of a Peter Tomasi and Chris Samnee short story that was written in Tales.
I did not know it was Samnee. Okay, I knew it was Tomasi. I didn't remember the Samnee part.
Yeah, and this is actually this short for this movie was actually written by Peter Tomasi.
Mm-hmm.
This was during a stretch of DC Animation where they went a few movies where they actually let the comic book writers write their own stuff, and the results were largely very good. Between yes. Batman Under the Red Hood and this, in my opinion, their two finest efforts. And what we see here is almost a direct adaptation of what Tomasi did in the comics, but kind of updated enough that it works in the context of this movie. And this is about why Kilowog is the way that he is, because Aresia thinks of him as this mean, gruff drill instructor, but Hal is telling the story about what's really behind Kilowog and why Kilowog acts the way that he does. And we get this awesome story that we've talked about before from the comics around the time of the – I believe it was one of the Tales of the Sinestro Corps that came out, Nick.
Was it Tales of the Sinestro Corps or Tales of the Tales of the Corps that came
Tales
out during,
of the Corps,
during
that's right,
Black,
yeah.
Blackest Night, right?
I think that might be it. And we started talking about this during our Geoff Johns Green Lantern countdown, I think, several months ago. And this is a story that kind of is about when Kilowog was a trainee just joining the Lantern Corps. He was a new recruit. And his drill instructor, Sergeant Deegan, is basically like – what was the guy from oh, God. I just had a brain fart, Nick. The dude from the – oh, shit. The Kubrick movie.
Full Metal Jacket?
Yes.
Arlie Ermey is the actor playing Sergeant
yes.
Gunnery.
Yep.
Oh, God. I forgot the character's name. But, yeah,
yes.
That guy.
Arlie Ermey, yes. So that's pretty much what we get here with Deegan. He is just a complete jerk, a complete douche to these recruits. He makes them go to a volcano planet without their rings and seemingly puts them in mortal danger and then strands them out in the middle of a wind planet that is just kicking up gusts of dusty wind. And gets them sucked into a sand sinkhole. And this whole time, Kilowog just starts steaming, so to speak, as you see there on the screen, as Deegan continues to put them in these terrible situations. But it really tells this amazing story of how the big, lovable Kilowog that we know came to be as gruff as he is.
Hey, Greg, interestingly enough, I just did a little bit of research. So one of the aspects of this that has changed from the comics, this was indeed first featured in Blackest Night, Tales of the Corps, number 3, the final installment of that 3-issue miniseries, created, let's see here. But interestingly enough, this character of Deegan in this film, who is playing Kilowog's drill instructor, is one of the characters that was pretty much overhauled for the film. In the original comic, he was a more humanoid-like creature with pointed ears and kind of a mohawk, and his mm-hmm. name was, interestingly enough, Ermey, in honor of Arlie Ermey.
Yeah, very interesting. So they definitely changed him around in appearance and in look, but his persona is very much the same.
Right.
He's very, very rough around the edges, but as we find out, when the going gets tough, as right now the recruits are getting called into an unexpected – well, not yet. He's about to have a fight with Kilowog, but in just a minute they're going to get called into an unexpected battle. And as we find out, he's got every bit the heroism and the courage that all the great Green Lanterns have. And we find out at the end that he was really just trying to make them as tough as possible so they'd be ready in situations like this. It's a very touching story. It's a side of Kilowog that you never get to see. And for me, it's not just one of the best parts of this movie, but it's also one of the best short stories in the entire Green Lantern repertoire.
Yeah, I mean, it's excellent. I can't really say enough good things about it, whether it's the animation, the voice acting, or just the general idea of the story. It's so perfectly executed both in the comic and here. I think probably by the end of this, we'll probably run down, you know, what our rankings of these five stories that are in here. But it's going to be tough for anything to top this. I think this, honestly, is one of, you know, it's not a very big pool of things to choose from when you're talking about Green Lantern adapted into a non-comics medium. But this might be the best Green Lantern-related thing that's ever been put on screen or film.
Wade Williams does the voice of Deegan, and he does an awesome job. Here's the one part where I may be controversial in. The one piece of casting in this
I'm going to agree with this. I think I know what
you're
going to say.
That I'm not nuts about is Henry Rollins as Kilowog.
I would agree, yeah. I would actually agree. The thing is, Henry Rollins as Kilowog, when you first, like, when you talk about it, it sounds like a great idea.
Salak reference, by the way. We see him for the first and only time in the movie.
But in actuality, he brings like this really understated performance to it, and that is not what Kilowog needs from somebody like Henry Rollins. You know, Henry Rollins
right.
brought crazy over the top Henry Rollins to Kilowog, and it would have been fantastic.
Right, and actually, it's interesting because I think what Michael Clark Duncan does in the movie is more along the lines of what I expect.
Yes.
Kilowog to sound like. And so that's the only – if there's one little bit of nitpicking I could do about this segment, it's that. But even that, he does – you know, they do a great job of getting around it, and especially I think it works better for the younger Kilowog, I think, where he's more like wide-eyed and, you know, naive. Older Kilowog, it doesn't work as much for because he needs to have that gruffness and that grit in his voice that he doesn't really have here. But that's the one bit of casting in this entire movie that I think was not what it could have been. Everything else, and by the way, who was the voice, the casting director here? Andrea Romano, who actually does one of the voices as well. She actually does the two voices. She does the voices of Abin Sur's ring and Deegan's ring. Uncredited, but Andrea Romano did an awesome job because this is one of the best casts you could possibly assemble. You have Nathan Fillion as Hal Jordan. You have Elizabeth Moss, mentioned a minute ago, as Arisia. We're going to get to this guy in a minute. Jason Isaacs as Sinestro. Can't say enough about him. Kelly Hu as Lyra. Of course, Rowdy Piper as Bullfunga. Arnold Vosloo as Abin Sur. Steve Bloom, who's a very famous voice actor, does Kloba Vud, who we'll talk about in a minute. And, of course, legendary pop star Michael Jackson as Ganthet. this is just a great casting all around. Some of these people I've not even heard of, but they're great voice actors, and they do awesome jobs. And, I agree with you, Nick. This is pretty damn perfect as an adaptation goes. It gets to the heart of everything. It's and this is honestly a format that I kind of wish that DC animation would take more often, given their often slavish devotion to that 70-minute runtime.
Right.
I would rather you have to add stuff into a story most of the time than take stuff out, although that can backfire, as we saw with The Killing Joke. But I'm saying this like anthology-type approach is something I wouldn't mind seeing more often.
No, I would agree. I would agree with that. But I think one of the things that I've read on some of the reviews of this film by some people who weren't as high on it as us, a lot of them came from people who weren't longtime Lantern fans. And they felt, by and large, that the anthology-style format made it difficult for novice viewers to come in and become emotionally attached to the characters, because by the time you got a solid understanding of who these characters were and what they kind of were motivated by, and you started to form a connection with them, you were on to the next set of characters. And so it kind of led to this, you know, choppy feeling in terms of emotional investment. I don't agree with that personally, but again, you know,
no.
We have that different perspective that, you know, a first-time viewer or a novice viewer would not have.
Yeah, and this is I've read that as well, Nick, and I definitely disagree. Granted, we, like you said, we have a biased view going into it because this is what we were looking for a long time as Green Lantern fans.
Mm-hmm.
But where I think I disagree with them is I think that we've seen in stuff like Tales from the Crypt and other anthology shows that's a valid approach to take. And I think in this case, the Green Lantern concept, it's never good to put it in a box. I feel like that's what they did with the movie. I feel like that's what they do a lot with Green Lantern, is they try to put it in a box with, well, it's not like other superhero stories. Where's our, you know, every man struggling to make it in New York City or whatever, you know? And it's like, you don't really need that with Green Lantern. It's an aspect of it, sure. We've gotten that in the past in Green Lantern. But I think that in something like this, when you're trying to expose the concept to the world at large, you need to focus on what makes it unique. I mean, think back to what hooked you as a Green Lantern fan, Nick. It was that Sinestro Corps special. What hooked me as a fan was Green Lantern Rebirth. And both of those stories take place primarily, if not almost entirely, in space. Mm-hmm. So I think that this is something that is really cool to show you. There should be a Green Lantern for everyone. Everyone should have their favorite Green Lantern, and it shouldn't be the same. Everybody's going to have different thoughts, and not even just Earth Lanterns either. Kilowog, everybody loves Kilowog, but maybe if you don't like Kilowog, maybe you like, I don't know, Chip or Nort or Sinestro or Abensur or Golias Gox or whatever his name is, the little the testicle with teeth, as Guy Gardner calls that race of people. Goliath Zed, I'm sorry. Bruce Timm voices him in the movie, actually. So just a really cool story here as we see the touching moment at the end of Kilowog earning his symbol. The voice acting – let's talk about the voice acting for a minute as we're about to transition to another story anyway. Running down this list, I think I hit all the heavy hitters on this one. Mm-hmm. Peter Jessup pops up as Salak. We see well, those are the main voice actors. What did you think about the casting in this one? How did you think everybody did?
Yeah,
how did you think long time talked about Nathan Fillion did finally playing Hal Jordan?
Nathan Fillion was fine as Hal Jordan. I thought he was very good. I thought the voice acting by and large across the board was excellent. I think Kilowog, like you said, was kind of the one probably weak link of the film, but even it wasn't so weak as to distract you or anything. This might be one of the better cast DC animated films because pretty much everyone knocks it out of the park, I thought. So nothing really to say here in a negative capacity whatsoever.
One that I really want to draw attention to, and he plays a bigger factor later in the movie, but Jason Isaacs as Sinestro is awesome.
Yeah, he's really good.
It really makes me upset that they never did anything more with the Green Lantern animated universe that came out of this, because good Lord, if they had ever followed through on that little glimpse that we got of the Sinestro Corps War in this movie, Nick, if they had actually done an animated Sinestro Corps movie, holy crap, he would have just killed it.
You know, time is not we hopefully we have many years left ahead of us, Greg. Hopefully the world is not ending in a bath of nuclear fire, but
I'll talk to my people about it.
So maybe it's still on the table, but you know, DC seems to just now, within the last year or so, be getting out of that only Batman and only Justice League thing they were in for a while. Because if you remember, pretty much after this, I want to say, this was like the last non-Batman or non-Justice League animated film they released for a long time. You know, eventually we got Teen Titans last year with the Judas contract, or was it this year? I can't remember. This year, maybe. And then, of course, we have the recently announced Superman or Death and Return of Superman two-part movie that's coming up, which will put Superman back in a starring role in one of these. So hopefully we are starting to see DC once again reach a little bit deeper into its well. And maybe that Sinestro Corps, maybe a two-part Sinestro Corps War animated adaptation is still in our future at some point.
That would be amazing, Nick. That would just tickle my fancy, as they say. And it would be a great opportunity for Jason Isaacs to come back, as, man, this guy kills it in this movie. Well, now we're moving on to another adaptation of a Green Lantern story. And this one comes from the early 90s, or the mid-90s, I believe. And this is about Lyra, who is a female Green Lantern who is known for her kind of constructs that are usually swords and blades of different kinds. And this particular short, I'm trying to remember who wrote this short for the movie and who wrote the comics it is based on. I'm drawing a blank at the moment. But nevertheless, this is another, I thought, another excellent.
Oh, this is one that's like, I've never been that big of a fan of Lyra in the comics and not really known like what drives her. She's never been somebody that I've been able to get into a lot, but this I would show to a lot of people who aren't Lyra fans and be like, this is kind of the approach they should be taking with her in the comics. It's kind of this female warrior take on her, kind of like in the way this one is structured, Greg. It's almost like an old like martial arts film where she's working her way through the Citadel here in a trio of excellent fight scenes, arguably perhaps the three best fight scenes in this film.
In the movie. It's almost like Game of Death,
It's incredibly well done, and I love all the little like set design and costume design aspects of this entire segment of the film. This was the one, when I did my rewatch of it in preparation for the podcast, I didn't even remember this, and I was like blown away all over again.
Totally. I mean, this is just the first fight that we're watching right here, and it's tremendous.
And each one gets progressively better, I think. Yep. Although this one and the second one are pretty much on the same wavelength, but that third one is like mind blowing,
and this is what I would like to show. This is what I would like to show the people who created the show Iron Fist, which I haven't watched, but. If it was as bad in fight scenes as you and others have said, this tells – it not only has three distinct fight scenes in a very short period of time, but each fight tells a story of how Lyra has to use her abilities in different ways and overcome aspects of her own personal attachments to win these fights. And so you're getting these awesome visuals, these great fights that tell stories within the story, which is what a great fight scene should do. It's you're right, Nick. It's some of the best animated fight scenes you'll ever see anywhere. It's tremendous. And by the way, the creators of the original story that this is based on were Ruben Diaz and Travis Cherist. I had heard of Travis Cherist. He was a pretty big art name back in the 90s. I do not know who Ruben Diaz is, but I've read this story. And the comic book story is really good, but controversial thought, Nick, I think this might be even better than the comic book version.
I don't recall reading the comic book version in my Green Lantern historical reading that I did. Perhaps they didn't include it because it wasn't a Hal Jordan story, but never heard of either of those guys. But regardless, if this is pretty close to what we got in the comics, then kudos to those guys for coming up with this concept. And a shame that if that was around the early 90s, we haven't seen that this take on Lyra utilized more often since then.
And this is actually, to me, what makes this better, Nick, is the changes that are made here is they make her a more – she's a warrior in the comics, but they make her almost more noble here. They make her more of a relatable character than she was. And she's good in the comics, and the comic is a great issue, but this is kind of even an improvement on that. And look at this fight scene, man. This is incredible. As she's fighting her brother, who looks like a reject from the Court of Owls, and she has to use the light to
you can
end
definitely
his tricks.
Feel the anime influence on this particular short, probably more so than any of the other ones, I would argue.
Yes, and she finally fells her brother, and what we're going to find in this last fight, she confronts her father, who has, against her wishes, turned her home planet of Jade into this warring planet that now is trying to eliminate the Kundians and anyone who gets in their way. And they're doing it through the family seal of the Gold Dragon. But what's brilliant about this scene, Nick, is it's not just a fight, a great fight between her and her dad. But what got me and what really hooked me on this was those little like this alien equivalent of photo albums, family photo albums that come out of these little jars that fall on the ground. And you see Lyra as a young girl playing with her father as she's fighting her father to the death. And it's really touching and it's really creative. And I love little shit like this because I love it when they make other planets have things that maybe are similar to our concepts, but different enough that it's believable that it wouldn't have come from Earth. Because too often you see things on other planets that are like, you know, photo frames that you'd find on Earth. And I think it's so cool to see something creative like this. This is what Star Wars does so well, is it does little stuff like this that makes you believe that this world exists. Really loved it.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, as we've said here, this short has, you know, three fantastic fight scenes. And during the first two, they make reference to her having familial ties with each of the first two individuals that she faces off with. But the difference here is they really drive home the emotional impact it is having on her and on her dad. And they do so through the usage of those little tools like you were talking about. So this one, while it is, I would argue, yes, the best choreographed fight scene of the three, it also carries the most emotional weight. And for that, it makes it, you know, just even that much better.
Yeah, and we also, as her dad kind of explains the history of their planet, this is where we're going to see Goliath Zed show up and get, unfortunately, taken out. It might not even be him. It might be one of their ancestors. But he gets taken out, unfortunately, and that seems to be a recurring theme among the the ball Green Lanterns. They don't tend to last very long.
No, the ball lanterns don't do very well.
Yes, that you'll find that trend if you read the comics. But yeah, really great stuff as they're laying out the unfortunate history of this Perius. Love him. They should just do a book of the ball lanterns, Nick. History of the ball lanterns.
And get some of the stalk lanterns to stand in between them.
Yes. Yes, that's brilliant. Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. Is there a black hole lantern that they could – I don't know. Maybe that's a bridge too far, Nick. But
you know who they need to get if they ever do a Blackest Night sequel, don't you?
Who's that?
Klondike Bill.
He is, I've been told, a sausage lover.
a sausage lover? What?
And I can see Klondike fitting into the Green Lantern Corps, or the Black Lantern Corps, for that matter.
Well, yeah, he's dead, so he would be being brought back in this instance.
Right, of course.
To get an emotional response out of Tony Schiavone and Conrad Thompson.
Conrad Thompson, who would actually join his side and be Black Lantern sympathizers.
Well, not that we hate no sympathy, yeah. No sympathizer.
We're not talking about that crap. Yes. So the ball lantern dies sadly, and his ring floats off into the waiting hands, not of Lyra's father, but of Lyra Omoto herself. And you know, another example of taking I'm not gonna say obscure, because she played a role later on in the Green Lantern Corps. But to your point, a character that was never really maybe taken advantage of in the right ways in the comics. And here we see how these obscure characters and these lesser known characters can be just as awesome as the superhero characters that we know and love. It's a really good example of taking someone that had potential and maximizing her minutes in the film, Nick.
Agreed. Absolutely agreed. This is the second instance in this film, by the way, that we see the ring passing someone by after it's seemingly within arm's reach. And it's interesting to think about how many characters have kind of had that experience in comics history. I know a lot of several different villains have kind of been motivated by that experience throughout the DC Green Lantern lore.
Including the one that we mentioned earlier, the First Lantern, the character in the comics. His primary motivation is that he was passed by for a Green Lantern ring and wanted to do anything it took to earn it. And that's another aspect of the Green Lantern mythology that people don't necessarily get at first. It was one of those things that was retconned over the years, but the concept that the ring chooses its wearer, mm-hmm. and it chooses it based on those who are able to overcome fear, and it also chooses it sometimes for reasons that no one's quite clear on. Mm-hmm. We've seen that a few times as well. Simon Baz is an instance of that, but we've also seen others throughout the history of the Green Lantern Corps that have had that situation. And it's another one of those little – every time you think you understand the Green Lantern mythos, there's a new little wrinkle in there that you can really delve into that makes it even that much more interesting. And it really is, to me – I've always said this, Nick, and you have as well, that it is – and I think this is probably what drew you to it, knowing your love of Star Wars, is that it's the closest thing, in my opinion, that comic books have to Star Wars.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Absolutely.
So – we talked a little bit about the voice acting, which is tremendous throughout. The writing involving the comic book writers in this, are you surprised that we haven't seen this happen more often with some of the adaptations and things that we've seen?
You know, yeah, a little bit, especially considering how we talked about it, you know, several months back. Under the Red Hood made the wise call of bringing in Judd Winnick to work on that, and it kind of wound up being, in our opinions anyway, one of, if not the best, DC animated films of all time. And so when they do this, it's almost always received extremely well. And for the most part, they're adapting a lot of relatively recent stories in their DC films right now. And it would seem like reaching out to the comic writers would be a natural step. Now, in the case of their Justice League films, a lot of them are based off of New 52 Justice League stuff, which would mean Geoff Johns would have to do it. And, of course, he doesn't really
incredibly busy, right?
He's a little preoccupied at the moment. So I can understand why it doesn't happen. But I'm hoping, you know, as we discussed earlier, as they seem to be preparing to dip back a little deeper into the well, that they'll once more be reaching out to comic book writers. I would hope that Dan Jurgens is at least going to have some level of involvement with
Death
that,
and Return.
With that Death and Return, seeing as how he's in good graces with the company already as it is.
Yeah, I would hope so as well. And yeah, I agree with you. I mean, Jeff, who is busier right now, do you think? Oh, this is a great sequence.
Yeah, it is. It's fantastic.
Who do you think's busier these days, Geoff Johns or The Rock?
Probably The Rock, seeing as how he's also having to fit in like 16 meals and like 4 hours in the gym every day, you know, as well. So I'm going to go with The Rock.
Yeah, that's you're right. They're adapting more modern works now, but I think this shows that there are still so many classic DC stories to be mined for stories. And don't get me wrong, I like it when they do original stuff too, but I kind of like seeing stuff like this get adapted. That maybe this is a story you mentioned you'd never read it, and a lot of people have never read it, and kind of exposing these stories to a wider audience that are great stories that maybe flew under the radar for in years past, and even updating them, and maybe as we saw with Under the Red Hood, even making improvements on them from the source material. So certainly, it's a valid approach to take, and this is awesome. As she's shooting green arrows at her father, which is another nice comic book nod. So, yeah. So the writing staff on these, we mentioned it. I don't know who exactly wrote this short, but now that I'm thinking about it, I think it was Eddie Braganza that wrote it. So the writing team is Eddie Braganza, Alan Burnett, Todd Casey, Dave Gibbons, who we'll talk about in just a minute because that's going to tie closely into our discussion of Hot Rod. Michael Green, Mark Guggenheim, Geoff Johns, and Peter Tomasi. Johns and Tomasi being the foremost Green Lantern creators of the modern era. Fair to say, Nick?
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that. I'm struggling to think of anyone, even in the history of the character, who would be up there on the same playing field as Johns. Tomasi, you could make the argument about a couple of guys, but it's pretty close to those, not just being the top two of the recent era, but possibly the top two ever, especially considering certain individuals are probably going to become persona non grata in the next few years.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Look at that rolling German suplex.
That's right. Beautiful. Let's deflect away from the nasty things in life with wrestling.
Yes. Let's deflect away from the nasty things in life by talking about rolling German suplexes. Yes. Oh, wait. Well,
Owen.
Owen.
Oh, damn it.
Daughter Diana. And, speaking
everyone's
of
nasty. Everyone's dead. God, they all died via horrible circumstances.
And we love him for it. Oh, good Lord. Nevertheless, thoughts and prayers to the family of Ric Flair, by the way, who is currently recovering, hopefully, from an ailment.
And to lend, you know, sorry, not to interrupt, but to lend more of the martial arts comparison here to this segment, he just committed seppuku, which was a nice touch.
Yes, yes, which is not to be confused with committing Harry Carey. As occasionally happens,
or Bukake
Cubs games, exactly. Oh gosh, there are countless stories, Nick, of people who, when they lost a fateful duel, committed Bukake to themselves.
It's yeah, I think it's called ultimatedomination.com. I think that's where you see such things. Oh, we are off the rails by even our
ultimate domination.
not quite what you're thinking of, Greg.
Another wrestler who passed too soon. But nevertheless, we are moving on to the next transition, and they're about to transition into what may be the most famous Green Lantern short story of them all. I think it's on a short list, and probably one that is known most by name. And that is a story from the 1980s by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons called Mogo Doesn't Socialize. Now, Alan Moore is not credited anywhere in this movie, and that is because Alan Moore has requested, nay, demanded to never be credited in any adaptation of his written work, and that includes mainstream DC work. So you will see, based on the DC Comics story co-created by Dave Gibbons, you will not see who he co-created it with. It's the equivalent of the WrestleMania 20 main event. So
good Lord, the references just continue to come.
So nevertheless, they did contact Dave Gibbons, and he was all on board for this. And so he actually writes this adaptation of one of his most famous works from the comics, one of the most famous Green Lantern stories from the comics. The introduction, as Aricia is finally told about the most powerful of the Green Lanterns, Mogo. And here is where our reasoning for this episode takes place, because
– here's one little – sorry, not to interrupt, Greg, but while I see it, I want to throw in one little nitpick, and it's something they've been doing in their animated films for a while, and I still don't think they've quite perfected it. When they try to mix the computer-generated animation and the practical animation, it never comes off well, in my opinion, because they just
– they did it in Justice League a few times. Yep.
They look too drastically different, and it just – it shows you how poor the level of the CGI is when it's placed against these rich, detail-oriented, hand-drawn backgrounds. So I just wanted to get that out of the way. I know we called it out, I believe, in the Killing Joke as well. It's a technique they still have not perfected after all these years.
Agreed. And it's a technique that I really don't think is necessary.
No, it's not. It's not.
So, this is where we come in, and the reason we're doing this episode, because one of the most infamous side characters, minor characters in the Green Lantern lore, is Balfunga the Unrelenting, who I understand has recently made a big bad comeback in the comics written by
In Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, which is written, of course, by Robert Venditti, yes.
Yeah, so Balfunga is an abrasive, overconfident loudmouth who goes throughout the universe proclaiming to be unbeatable in combat. He even names himself Balfunga the Unrelenting. So he has been used since this story as a comedy character of sorts, mostly in Green Lantern lore. But this was his actual first appearance. This was Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons creating this character. And he is traveling the cosmos. And in this movie, he is voiced by none other than Rowdy Roddy Piper. And I know I'm biased going into it, but I thought Piper was perfect for this role.
Yeah, he was great. It's a little bit gruffer, you know, than you think of when you think of Roddy Piper, because you think of that 80s voice, or at least I do anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost wonder if perhaps a little bit younger Hot Rod might not have worked a little bit better for the role. But even so, he was outstanding.
Yeah, and for me, I think that gruffness kind of fit the alien nature of it. And where, you know, there's a few – and honestly, it's hard to pick out that it's Piper's voice at times until he starts really getting into it. And he's like, I'm Balfunga the Unrelenting. And then you can hear it. And it's like, okay, yeah, I get it. And I think Piper does a great job here of playing a character that he could probably relate to, because Balfunga is one of the most pro wrestling characters in all of Green Lantern.
Right, right. And it's interesting here because, like you said, he's mostly known for a lot of his comedic elements. But they kind of portray him here in this short a little bit more as a straight-up physical threat than we are accustomed to.
Yeah, he goes around and he basically is killing all these creatures and about ready – he's cut this poor creature's forearms off and is about to cut his head off. And the creature tells him about Mogo, this creature that Balfunga has yet to slay. And it's one of the great swerves in the history of comics, honestly, of any single issue, because – when you're reading this for the first time, you have no idea where it's going or what the twist is. And when the twist finally hits, I have no idea if it worked for people in the animated form like it did in the comics, because obviously you and I both knew what the story was all about.
Right.
But in the comics, I'll never forget the first time I read it and realized what it was and what it meant. It was one of those like holy shit moments that you don't think about and until it happens.
And see, I had read it after I had read Sinestro Corps, so you know.
You already knew that Mogo was the planet.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah, I read it back in the 90s in a. And a random Green Lantern trade that I read at the bookstore, and I remember just being like, holy cow, like what in the world? What a great twist. What a great Alan Moore thing to do to totally change your expectations going in. And it's really – I don't want to spoil it necessarily for those who don't know. Pretty much everybody listening to this is going to know. But it's one of those awesome swerves of – all of Green Lantern lore. So check this one out if you get a chance. I love this one too, Nick. I thought this was damn near a perfect adaptation of one of the great stories. Now, granted, it's hard to replicate that moment from the book, mm-hmm. but I think they do as good a job as possible on this. I think Piper is great. I think how they portray the gradual frustration of Bullfunga is quite humorous in this as well.
Yes, I would completely agree, and they kind of give you hints of what exactly is going on as he tears his way through the jungle. Here you'll see little bits of animation that are hinting at the true nature of Mogo.
Yeah, it's definitely they're definitely hinting at what's going on. And Bullfunga, what's funny about Hal's story, Nick, I didn't remember, is I don't remember if it's like this in the comic or not, but it almost, he's saying that okay, this goes on for days and days of Bullfunga storming around trying to find this Green Lantern Mogo. And then he goes – and then days turn into weeks. And then weeks turn into months. So it gives you – at least it gave me the mental idea of Bullfunga almost cartoonishly parading around for a calendar year doing nothing. Absolutely nothing of any substance.
Well, he's had enough time to build this shelter, you know, this elaborate shelter on the planet. So clearly he's been there a while.
He destroys his drones, his poor little drones, and then like a minute later says, deploy new drones.
Yes. He's not on like Darkseid in that regard with yes. Calibac. Calibac.
Poor Calibac. Oh, man. Folks, if you haven't seen some of the great panels of Darkseid and Calibac, just look up our old countdown article of the 5 worst comic book dads, and you'll see some of our favorite images of Darkseid, where he kills his son in cold blood and then mourns the fact that he has to bring him back to life. So you know, as we progress in this, Nick, we've kind of covered a lot of ground here. As far as Mogo doesn't socialize, how does this one compare to the comic to you? Is this one that worked for you, or is this one that falls short?
No, it definitely works for me, although I will say I think – the comic is so perfect. Like,
yeah.
I don't think it – some of these other ones that they've chosen to directly adapt, there were ways to enhance upon it and there were ways to do it better. And I think Mogo's Doesn't Socialize is almost a perfect story where it was going to be really difficult to improve upon it in either way – in any way. Mm-hmm. And so what I would say is they managed to live up to that legacy, but they certainly don't surpass it the way the Lyra story did or the way the Kilowog story did.
Agreed. And, you know, it's interesting because they keep this one probably the closest of all of the adaptations.
And because of reason,
there's,
because
yeah,
what,
there's nothing
what
you
can
could
you
really
do? Yeah.
There's nothing you could do to make it any better. And it's one of those things like Watchmen where it's probably always going to be impossible to directly replicate the experience of reading it. To where even, you know, we love the film Watchmen, but it still doesn't replicate the experience of reading it, but something that might
– I was about to say, luckily
– something that might replicate the experience of reading the greatest graphic novel of all time is coming up here close to the end of this month here, the last week of August. You're going to be experiencing comic book theater Watchmen.
If you've got a Watchmen itch, just bend over and we'll go ahead and scratch it.
We will. And we are going to attempt to do what Mogo Doesn't Socialize could not. And not only live up to, but surpass the source material. That's right, folks. We're taking the greatest graphic novel of all time and we're turning it into the greatest piece of media of all time. As we do our own voice acting, we make our own imprint on some of the most famous characters, original creations of all time.
They say, Greg, that acting is nothing but a series of choices, and we have certainly made some choices in this adaptation.
And it ties in perfectly because Dave Gibbons wrote this, and Dave Gibbons drew Watchmen, and I feel Dave Gibbons will be very proud of what we've done, Nick.
We should send it, tag him on Twitter whenever we start promoting this.
That's a wretched idea. by the way,
but you know who we should tag that's not a wretched idea? Peter David.
That's true. That's true. I would love to hear how he reacts to not having written Watchmen.
I've never written Watchmen.
Now here's the question for you, Nick.
Yes.
Does Mogo kill Bofunga here?
No, I think he just sucks him back down to the planet and screws with him some more and eventually lets him go.
Using some tendrils, no doubt.
I think he's been screwing with him for the better part of a year. So
that's true. It's probably just humorous to him at this point. Yeah, what were you saying?
No, Nick? I just finally picked up on your tendrils thing. And we're working in hentai. We're working in bukkake. We're working in harikiri. We're working in seppuku.
Right.
Everything here.
If you were a planet and you had a guy stuck on you for a year, would you screw with him? I would.
I'm going to the land of harikiri in less than a month now. Very much looking forward to it.
Wrigley Field, home of gum and harikiri and Bill Murray.
Hey, maybe I'll see Bill Murray or CM Punk.
You might. You could see any of them. Or AJ Lee.
Oh.
Here we see a really nice callback as Lyra shows up with her blades that we're familiar with from the comics. And makes a nice little save. I love these shots of the Corps working together, helping each other out, watching each other's backs, using their rings in different ways. Kilowog wants to stay and fight these creatures and yet has to get kind of talked into retreating a little bit later on in the movie. Sinestro with a badass emerald bomb that he just threw in. I don't even know how that works, but that was awesome. And here we get a really rare tender moment from Sinestro as he's kind of seemingly the only one there kind of caring for Aresia as she's recovering from her injuries. She gets knocked out in the course of the battle. What do you think? Why we always advocate for this, Nick, but I guess we should talk about why we think it's so good that they use Sinestro in this role and we get to see the noble side of Sinestro before his turn. Why is it so important?
Because the root of any great villain is being able to understand their point of view. And it's much more difficult to understand Sinestro's point of view if you lose half of his story in the background. You lose, you know, if you have him as just a villain, you lose that personal connection to Hal, that personal connection to the Corps, and you lose all that empathy that you're supposed to have with him that makes him arguably one of, if not the most relatable villain in all of comics. And so to have him as nothing more than a villain, in my opinion anyway, is a disservice to the character. And yes, I say that understanding that in the early days, in the Silver Age, you know, he and Hal never served in the Corps at the same time. That was an invention of the 90s and an invention of a writer who shall not be named once again. But now that that's canon, I don't see any reason why adaptations shouldn't be taking that route. And I understand that the first theatrical film and, yes, First Flight as well, both did versions of that. But I would argue they cut their knees out from under themselves by going back on it before film's end.
Yep, and it's also a case of what I will call Star Wars prequel syndrome, where they tell instead of show this relationship between the two leads. That's one of the things that I love about this. We're on to a new short story here called Abin Sur, which is a retelling of probably the second most famous Green Lantern short story, or the most famous, you could make an argument, certainly the most influential of the short stories, which would be Tigers, also by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. Or actually, Alan Moore and it wasn't Dave Gibbons that drew that one. I'll come back to that. But Tigers is the most influential story because it forms the backbone of Jeff Johns' entire Green Lantern run. And what we're getting right here is a Geoff Johns written version of Tigers, a retelling of it that ties into his secret origin story and also the original Tigers, and also just an original creation as well, as we get Atrocitus and Abin Sur having a throwdown. But what ends up happening is Sinestro comes to Abin's aid, and we get to see – I will compare it to Qui-Gon Jinn and Obi-Wan Kenobi relationship, and then transitioning into the Anakin and Obi-Wan relationship after that, although the personality dynamics are a little bit different there. Sinestro right. is more like Anakin. Abin is more like Qui-Gon probably, and Hal is probably more like Obi-Wan. But – with all that being said, that's kind of the comparison I would show here. We get to see Sinestro and Abin Sur working together, not just as co-workers, as Green Lanterns, but as friends, as brothers, and two people with different philosophies that are working together. And you, of course, see that in this movie also with Hal and Sinestro. And like you were saying, Nick, it's so important because that's why Sinestro's turn has – dramatic weight. Otherwise, he's just a literal mustache-twirling villain if you don't have that relationship between he and Hal. And if you don't have the idea that Sinestro was doing what he's doing with noble intentions, even if his actions are despicable at times. And you also get this great idea here that Sinestro is actually, whether he admits it or not, influenced by – what happens to Abin Sur and by Abin's experiences here. Sinestro makes it clear he doesn't believe in destiny. He thinks everything is, you know, every man is in control of his own destiny. Abin Sur believes in destiny, and he's been told by Atrocitus here, the seed of doubt has been planted in him about the ability of the Green Lantern rings and about his impending doom. And I really, really, really love this short. This is – we'll talk about it towards the end, but all of these have been great. But this is damn fine stuff here. I am just such a mark for seeing Sinestro as a Green Lantern and actually working alongside Abin and their kind of buddy but adversarial relationship with each other, you know, how they're kind of like disagreeing with each other as they solve problems and fight Atrocitus and they save a spaceship at one point. Nick, what are your thoughts on this one and how it kind of combines two famous Green Lantern stories as Geoff Johns writes this one?
Yeah, I love this one as well. Like you said, it's just so cool getting to see some of our favorite aspects of the Green Lantern mythos adapted here in this one. As we'll see here in a little bit, just a little flash forward to a potential Sinestro Corps war. We'll see kind of what we have been told, you know, in the Geoff Johns run was the whole impetus for the Blackest Night and the War of Light and things like that. If I have to make one little nitpick, I will say I'm not crazy about the redesign of Atrocitus they go with here. I like the comics design a lot better, but other than that, not really a whole lot you can nitpick. The only other thing would be I really wish we had gotten to see a version of Kull of the five inversions rather than Atrocitus, you know, taking over his role for him. But I understand why that change was made to make it sync up a little bit better with those people who had just maybe recently read Secret Origin or something more contemporary.
Right. No, I can agree with that. But I understand that they had to, cut out something because they were trying to fit in a lot here in this one. And I really appreciated how Johns managed to tell such a compelling relationship for two characters that you really only see together for a combined maybe 5 minutes in the movie. And it's interesting, and it's makes you feel why Sinestro would start to perhaps have doubts about the Guardians. And the artist, by the way, on this story was Kevin O'Neill. It was Alan Moore and Kevin O'Neill who did Tigers. And this was the story that kind of birthed the concept of the emotional spectrum of the War of Light. Certain characters like Sodom Yat, who would be a big Green Lantern character in the latter part of the aughts, if you will. So yeah, this one really works for me. I really enjoy Jason Isaacs, Sinestro, and enjoy seeing Abin Sur as he is told, essentially, by Atrocitus exactly what is going to happen in the Green Lantern's future, that there will be this War of Light, that a core led by Sinestro and comprising some of the worst villains of the universe would destroy the Green Lanterns and rule the universe with an iron fist. And Abin doesn't believe it because he has too much faith in his friend. He says – he even says, I almost believed you until you had Sinestro. You chose the wrong lantern to go down that path because Sinestro will never make that mistake. And that's what reminds me of Obi-Wan and his faith in Anakin from Star Wars, except told, in my opinion, a little bit better and a little bit more where you get to see why he feels that way as opposed to just be told it. So I think this is a really good job of crystallizing that concept.
Yeah, I would completely agree. It's just a very, very well done adaptation here.
And with that being said, folks, all that we kind of have left is the wrap up of the main plot, which, if I'm being honest, is probably the weakest aspect of this movie. In fact, I would say it certainly is.
Which it isn't bad. It's just, you know, it's clearly not the focus. Like, it's only here to have some sort of tie, between the stories.
It's the connective tissue for this movie between all these short stories. And it also, what we see at the end is kind of a moment for Aresia, because that's the one thing we don't get in this, is we don't get the Aresia short story. But what we get instead is she ends up being the one that saves the day. Well, her and an assist from the famous Green Lantern Mogo that, again, don't want to spoil for you, but Mogo and Aresia get to be the ones that save the day, and it's Aresia's creativity. Lisa Drax, I didn't even notice that the last time. I saw Lisa Drax and Crib in the background there, Nick.
Yeah, I noticed them because I noticed Arkillo and it was very quick. There was another character I noticed, but I didn't see that time.
So you get to see Aresia save the day and get her moment that ties her thread together. So it's fine. It's fine. It's mainly there to bridge the gap and to give a little payoff moment for Aresia. But ultimately, they defeat Krona very easily. Not very easily, but very quickly. And the real draw to this movie are the short stories. So before we get into ranking these stories, Nick, overall thoughts on this one, as a Green Lantern fan and just as a comic book fan, what are your thoughts on Green Lantern Emerald Knights?
I think it's easily, of the three, the best Lantern film that's ever been made. And I would say it is right up there with the Green Lantern the Animated Series as the best Green Lantern adaptation. Both are excellent. It's something that if you're not a Green Lantern fan, I would recommend to you and just see if you can – see if it appeals to you. I really can't say for sure how it plays to people who aren't major Green Lantern fans like yourself and I. And if by some chance of some whatever you're a Green Lantern fan and you haven't seen this, go out of your way to seek it out. I think it's one of the best DC animated films that they've ever produced.
Yeah, I echo those sentiments. This is one of my favorites in the DC pantheon. I think it's my ideal version of how these characters can be presented, and almost makes me wish that we could have a world where animated films could be as profitable as live action, because ultimately Green Lantern maybe works better as an animated property than it does as a live action property. I don't know, but this is pretty damn awesome. And like Nick said, if you're a Green Lantern fan and you haven't seen this, go out of your way. Order it through Amazon. Find a copy of it. Use whatever you have to do, because you're not going to regret it if you're a Green Lantern fan. If you're not, give it a try. And maybe I think that if you're a fan of sci-fi, if you're a fan of concepts like Star Wars, like Lord of the Rings, things of that nature, high fantasy and sci-fi, I think you'll dig this. Now, let's look at these stories, Nick, and rank them in our opinions based on our enjoyment. I think we liked all of them, but let's go. You want to go 5-1 or 1-5?
Your choice.
Let's see. Well, let me make sure I got the numbers right here. 1, 2, 3, 4.
There are five.
Five. It's five. Yeah. So we're not counting the overall
plot.
Not
counting the main story, right?
Yep. Okay. Let's go 5-1. Yeah, just because, you know, that's how we like to do things around here. I am going to – oh, God, I hate to do this because I love all of these, but I'm going to probably go the first Lantern at 5, mm-hmm. even though I greatly enjoyed it. I'm going to go Mogo Doesn't Socialize at 4. Again, amazing, and shout out to the Hot Rod. Great stuff. I'm going to go Man, I'm going to go a little different. I'm going to go Kilowog at 3. Mm-hmm. And again, phenomenal. And I'm going to go Lyra at 2, and I'm going to go Abensur at 1. What about you, Nick?
I am going to go First Lantern at 5, Mogo Doesn't Socialize at 4, Lyra at 3, Abensur at 2, and Kilowog at 1.
Excellent. Excellent. And really good stuff here. Check this movie out. As we mentioned, unfortunately, I don't think it's available streaming anywhere. If you can find us, let us know. Tweet us. I am at gphillips8652. He's at nickduke87. Send us an email, gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com. Join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. We have a lot of good discussion there, a lot of good links there. We'll be happy to discuss this movie with you, the adaptations, your memories of your favorite Green Lantern stories that you'd like to see adapted, things of that nature. And, of course, if you go to placetobenation.com and you find this article, you can comment below with your Discuss account, and we'll be happy to engage with you on there as well and have a nice little discussion about Green Lantern. We always like talking Green Lantern. That's another interesting thing. I just kind of threw it out there, Nick. Are there any other Green Lantern short stories from over the years that you would like to see adapted in animation at some point?
Well, I think St. Walker comes to mind most instantly. You could pretty much do that entire – I think it was three stories in each issue, that three-issue Tales of the Core from Blackest Night. You do those 9 stories, and those are all pretty much across the board excellent. You'd have the Dextar story in there, which I think a lot of people would like to see. As I said, the St. Walker one, little glimpses of what's going on at the Indigo Corps. You got so many things that you could pull from there. So while some of them I don't remember particularly well, I do remember just loving that 3-issue run. So that'd be what I would mind first.
Yeah, and I would also like to see maybe the Lisa Drax story that we've gotten before, who was the winged Red Lantern? Starts with a B.
Bleez,
yes. Her story is tragic. It would be awesome to see. So there's all kinds of great ones like that. Those are really good ones that pop to mind and would be certainly welcome by the hard-traveling fanboys. That being said, folks, stick with us through the break. We hope you enjoyed this off the page, and let us know what you thought of the show. Let us know what you think of the movie. And when we come back, we're going to have the usual read and watching and the rundown. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of The Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com. And we offer those to you on 3 great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Coming soon from the creative minds of the Place to Be Nation Pop Network, the audio adaptation that no one was asking for, but everyone deserved. Place to Be Nation Pop Comic Book Theater presents Watchmen, an audio feast for your ears. Thrill to the exploits of the comedian.
These are demons. It's an intergalactic invasion into this space through people. They have sexual rituals, some of the most ancient Egyptian rituals, where they believe they are possessed by entities. Space aliens.
Silk Spectre.
Good. Hey, licking your finger, it's like licking a battery. It's all sort of...
Night Owl.
Yeah, well, you know how it goes. Sometimes I come down here and sit around a little bit, think about the times when we were making the towns, doing the drugs, fucking the rats.
Dr. Manhattan.
Clearly you don't really care about what stimulates me.
Ozymandias.
Puta. The Soviets, Vietnam, anyone, Mila Jovovich,
and Rorschach.
But what it doesn't change is the fact, and this is something we can all agree on, that all of the whores and politicians will look up and they'll shout, "Save us, JR," and I'll look down and I'll whisper, "Ma."
You won't believe your ears. You won't believe the dark places your imagination will take you. Featuring cameos from some of your PTBN favorites.
Baby, that's quite a drop, I said.
Oh, they just pay me to handle monsters in outer space? No, no.
Maybe it was a couple of guys and they overpowered him.
He cometh up and swerve, cut down like a flower.
Fly me to the moon, let me fuck amongst my star. Oh, I guess Dr. Osterman finally arrived.
You remember this gimmick, guys?
Okay, number one, big blue dick. You don't bring it up. It's big, it's there, it's wagging.
It's Watchmen, the greatest graphic novel of all time, as you've never heard it before. Transformed into the most self-referential collection of in-jokes on this or any other medium. Only from the hard-traveling fanboys and Place to Be Nation Pop.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the second half, or the second portion, probably not half, of the broadcast. And again, we wanted to celebrate the two-year anniversary, not celebrate, I guess, but look back on the two-year anniversary of the death of Roddy Piper, one of the greats of all time. And we are ready to get into our recurring features here. And we're going to start. What could this be?
I think it'd be best for our emotional stability and our psyche if we just unplugged it. I know we've had it for a long time. I know it's there, and I know it's going to be a change, but I feel like it's just going to be depressing every time we go to it, and I think it's time to put it into storage, as they say.
I think you could be right, Nick. I think you could be right.
But go ahead, read it to us if you feel the need.
I'm taking the sheet of paper out, and now that sound was me throwing the ticker into the garbage, Nick.
No, don't throw it in the garbage. One day it might be useful again. Just put it in the storage.
Get your ass over to this side of the L-shaped table and get it out
of
the garbage.
I'm not the one who threw it in the garbage, so how about you do it?
Well, I've been told that there are people that are paid to do that.
To take things out of the garbage for you?
Yes. Yes. I have my own Elron.
You're a waste.
I have an L. Ron Hubbard that follows me around and preaches Scientology.
That's what you are.
So what this sheet of paper says on it here is Ho Ho Loon still unemployed by World Wrestling Entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Nope. Just put it in the damn closet, Greg.
It's now trapped in the closet, right alongside the great R. Kelly.
And John Travolta.
But let's kick things off with our weekly segment where we talk about what we've been delving into in the world of comics this past week. It's a segment known as
Reading and Watching Out. What you been reading and watching?
What you been reading and watching?
Reading and watching.
Greg, I have a question for you.
Sure.
What's your favorite gif of all time, and why is it the Katy Perry and Elmo shirt gif?
She's a handsome young woman. We're going to kick things off with reading this week, and I, Gregory Bartholomew, that's not my real middle name, Phillips, have been reading comics for a change. Isn't that delightful, Nick?
It's delightful. It's shocking is what it is. So let's
Let's just say that certain activities have been more frequently occurring last week. So it's opened the door for more reading opportunities. But
not to tell tales out of stool.
But you can relate.
See what I did there?
Stool. Yes. Very good, Mr. Wayne. And Mr. Lau. So I'm gonna start off with my number three book of the week. And that book is none other than Aquaman number 14. This is part of – and you're going to notice this trend in my books because I mainly read Aquaman comics this past week. This is a part of the Deluge story arc that I've been reading in recent weeks. And this introduces us on the cover to the Aquamarines as they try to infiltrate Atlantis on behalf of the United States of America, and they attempt to assassinate Arthur Curry, Aquaman. And in the process, they take out several of the top political leaders in Atlantis and assassinate them. Aquaman defeats them, overcomes them, but instead of punishing them or killing them as his people want him to do, he keeps them alive. And he decides to make one last chance to broker peace, take one last stab at brokering peace with the U.S. He also finally, on the last page, discovers who's been running Nemo and finds Black Manta stowed away on this ship, learns that he's the head of Nemo, and shit's about to hit the fan. This is just really, really great stuff overall. The Aquamarines, I could take or leave, to be honest with you, Nick, and that's why this finishes third for me. But the overall story continues to be awesome. The fight scenes are good, and I just love the characterizations of Aquaman and of Mira here as she finally decides to intervene to save Arthur when he's in trouble. So really digging this story. This is Dan Abnett and Felipe Briones, not Rob Baronis, the old Titans kicker, as I mentioned last week. So, yeah, just really good stuff here. Aquaman continues to kick butt.
Yeah, glad to hear it. I knew you and I kind of feel pretty similar about the Aquamarines. Just kind of something you have to deal with, and then the book picks up massively after that. I can go ahead and tell you that. Moving on to my number three book of the week, I've got Teen Titans number 10. This is the latest installment of the Blood of the Manta storyline. I am still weeks behind on comics at this point, and so I'm only going to be giving you a top three and a bottom one here because I just don't want to bore you with tales of books that are weeks old, unlike certain other individuals on this show. But in any event, Teen Titans number 10, enjoyed this one a lot. Probably one of my favorite issues of Teen Titans to date, just because it features so much Black Manta in it, and Ben Percy writes a hell of a Black Manta. His pompousness is there, and his almost you can almost see the sneer on his face through the giant Black Manta helmet, which is cool. So enjoyed this one, and they're moving forward. The idea of how leadership is affecting Damian as well, very well in this book also. So a lot of good things to say about this one. So Teen Titans number 10 is my number three.
Really seems like Teen Titans is picking up steam lately.
Yeah, once they added in Aqualad and kind of had, you know, started playing with that idea of Damian having to adapt to the team a little bit more as opposed to just being, you know, the same old Damian, it's really started to gain some momentum.
Very good. Moving on to my number two book of the week. It's actually the conclusion of the Deluge, the finale, and this is Aquaman number 15. Mm-hmm. This is where everything kind of hits the fan. Aquaman has a knockdown, drag-out fight with Black Manta again, and Manta makes a shocking sacrifice, seemingly, at the end of this book, where he, again, seemingly commits suicide in order to protect the secrets of Nemo and potentially make things difficult for Aquaman when it comes to brokering a peace between Atlantis and the U.S. All the while this fight's going on, we're getting a monologue from Arthur, and we don't know who he's delivering it to or what the circumstances are. And at the end of the issue, we find out that he's delivering this monologue to the President of the United States. And it's just a tremendous issue. And it continues much of the theme of Dan Abnett's run on this book, which has been Aquaman is almost the least cliched superhero we've ever seen at this point, because he is the one superhero who is always looking to solve issues with diplomacy, with his words rather than his fists or with anything else. He's a lot like Wonder Woman in that way, actually. But Aquaman and Wonder Woman are kind of those two characters that we see who really try to actively avoid conflict at all costs. It's very interesting, it's very compelling, and very refreshing, I think. So I really enjoyed this one. I couldn't give it my top spot because I didn't think it was quite the best issue in this story arc, but it was really good, and I thought they stuck the landing. Mira's subplot continues to interest me, and I'm very excited to see where it's going.
Yeah, glad to hear that as well. The Deluge was a hell of an Aquaman story, in my opinion. But moving on to my number two, I've got The Defenders number four. This seemingly wraps up the first little mini story arc of this title, and I gotta say I enjoyed it a hell of a lot. It was mainly focused on Jessica and Danny, of all people, ultimately being the ones that brought home the W, so to speak, for the Defenders as they took on the villain Diamondback, and loved it. Jessica was written expertly, as she always is, by Brian Michael Bendis. She plays a key role. And then me actually getting to see a version of Iron Fist that is entertaining and a competent hand-to-hand fighter, unlike the Iron Fist of the television show, was also a nice change of pace. So enjoyed the hell out of this one, and looking forward to the next story arc, which seemingly is going to put the Defenders at odds with one Frank Castle.
Ooh, interesting. That's good synergy there, too, for Marvel with their television property there. So my number one book of the time period, and I kind of gave it away a little bit a minute ago, but it's actually Aquaman number 13, which is it's act two of the deluge. And I think this is one of the best issues of the entire Dan Abnett Aquaman run. It's Scott Eaton on art, and I always enjoy Scott Eaton's art. I prefer his over Felipe Briones. And I thought this was tremendous. The Justice League arrives in Atlantis to confront Aquaman because they think he's at war with America. He tells them what's going on, and this is the biggest shock of all, Nick. They actually believe him. And they say, you know what? You're our longtime friend. We actually believe you're telling us the truth. Let's try to help you solve this problem. And so they don't fight. They actually help Arthur uncover this mystery and find evidence and try to broker a peace between the U.S. and Atlantis, even though it doesn't work. This whole issue is filled with political intrigue, with Aquaman. With the readers getting to see how Aquaman relates to the members of the Justice League, whether it be the relative inexperience of Simon and Jessica as they're reacting to seeing Atlantis for the first time, or whether it's with Aquaman's oldest and dearest friends of Bruce and Clark and Diana and Barry. Barry even lightening the tone a little bit in the proceedings. And, you know, it's just really, really well-written stuff by Dan Abnett. And it makes me wish, Nick, like you mentioned this a few podcasts ago, that I really wish that Dan Abnett could get an extended run with Justice League, because I think he'd kill it. And ultimately, we get one of the most unexpected and violent endings to an Aquaman comic that I've read, which is Joanna Stubbs' father, who works for Nemo, gets basically imploded by Black Manta. He hits a button and it sets off these coral deposits that had been put into his brain, and you literally see his head just almost burst from within and turn into this icky mess. It's incredibly violent, but not going to lie, it was pretty awesome. So this is my number one book of the time period.
Well, I'm glad to hear you love the storyline as much as I did. Moving on to my number one, I've got Detective Comics 961. This continues the Intelligence storyline. You know, this story has been very Azrael-focused. It's almost like each arc of Detective Comics since Rebirth started has been – you know, we've mentioned before how well it juggles all the members of this new little bat team they've got going on. But each individual story arc has kind of given the focus to a different member of the team, whether it was League of Shadows giving the focus to Cassandra, or the earlier Batwoman-focused storyline that kicked off the Rebirth era that was then followed by the Tim Drake focused era. It was just, it's been a great series for Detective Comics. And so here we have Azrael kind of getting the forefront. It kind of reminds you of the fact that there was some potential in that character back in the 90s before everything went straight to hell. Kind of showing you how they can use him in a heroic light and how he can be used as an interesting counterpoint to Batman in terms of their own personal philosophies as it relates to faith and spirituality and that sort of thing. But really, the reason this one makes my number one spot is I have always been a sucker for the Batman-Zatanna dynamic and the romantic chemistry here in this one, even while both of them are acknowledging that there's no way that it will ever happen between them and that Bruce is okay with that because of he makes reference to what's going on with him and Selina. The flashbacks they show are just so well written that it makes me wonder if there isn't a lot of material to mine there in future years for future writers to maybe go back to that dynamic at some point. But loving the hell out of Detective Comics. Still, in my opinion, the most consistent Bat book on the stands, but although Tom King's Batman is nipping at its heels in recent months.
I'm going to steal a line from you, Nick, and repurpose it for my own. Zatanna needs to keep her damn filthy hands off of Selena's man.
Well, fair enough. And she, in the current day, she does, Greg. You'll be very happy to hear that.
That's very good. Let's go to my bottom book of the period. And this is not going to earn me fans among some of our listeners and even my co-hosts here. But for the second time in the last three readings, I think, maybe the second time in a row for my readings anyway, my bottom book of the week is a Green Arrow issue. And it's Green Arrow number 14, which is another part of the Emerald Outlaw storyline. This is by Ben Percy and really a cavalcade of artists. There's like three different artists listed here, and they don't divide them by inkers or colorists or what have you. So I don't know exactly what the deal is, but it's the art's okay. I really didn't have much of an issue with the art. It's fine. But man alive, if this dialogue just does not do it for me. This story has not done it for me. I love the fact that it introduces Malcolm Merlyn. This is the time that – this is where we see that it's revealed that Malcolm Merlyn is the guy that's been committing these murders. But there was really no build to it. There was really no – it almost feels like they're going for a hush thing because at one point Ollie even thinks in his inner monologue – I never gave up when we were kids, Tommy. Like, he thinks it's Tommy Merlyn, even though it's Malcolm Merlyn. But there was no build-up to that. There was nothing in the issues preceding this that even mentioned the name of Tommy Merlyn or Malcolm Merlyn. It wasn't like the Tommy Elliott reveal in Hush where it really got built well over a period of time. The dialogue to me is just not good. Like, this chief character comes off to me like the character – if anybody's ever seen So I Married an Axe Murderer – the actual police chief in that movie that is intended to be – like he just delivers lines from movie police chiefs to try to be a generic angry movie police chief. That's everything this guy says, including this bit of dialogue. Everybody, every last one of you, I don't care if your shift's over or if it's your grandma's funeral or you think you found Jimmy Hoffa in 2017. Just none of this works for me, honestly. The dialogue's really weak across the board. Ollie's inner monologue is good, and the confrontation between he and Malcolm is good, and Black Canary's development is good. But overall, man, this story is really losing me.
Well, agree to disagree. I will agree, however, that Emerald Outlaw is not one of the stronger story arcs, and it ultimately winds up being something of a setup for Rise of Star City. But you know, you certainly have your opinions on Green Arrow, and who am I to tell you that you're wrong, even if you are? So we'll move on to my bottom book of the week, and I've got Wonder Woman 27. This is the second part of the Heart of the Amazon storyline. You know, I know a lot of people, yourself included, and Russell and several other people, who dropped Wonder Woman once Greg Rucka left, and I kind of was willing to give it, you know, the benefit of the doubt and hang on for a few issues until we got to James Robinson to see what it was all about. And after Wonder Woman 26, I felt not completely justified in that decision, but at least I was not regretting the decision to keep the book. I thought 26 was a pretty good little story. The art wasn't as bad as some of the preview pages had made it out to be, and I was feeling pretty good about this new creative team. Not great, but decent, solid, not too shabby, fair.
Fair.
But Wonder Woman 27 is something of a train wreck. From inconsistent plotting to inconsistent characterization to consistently below average art, just everything about it is kind of bad. The villains are uninteresting. Their version of Etta Candy is pretty uninteresting. And really the only thing that even makes the book readable is that, you know, they seem to have a decent enough handle on Diana and kind of the turmoil she's going through in her life after the events of the Greg Rucka run. So this book gets a big thumbs down from me, but I won't say it was like absolute garbage or anything. I'm just I am now just waiting for this book to hit the James Robinson run, and we'll go from there.
Very good. And we're not going to do any quick hits, we mentioned. So let's go on to watching. Mm-hmm. Nick, I understand you recently completed something.
Yeah, not so much watching, but I did finish playing the first episode of the second season of the Telltale Studios Batman game, which was titled The Enemy Within. I know last week I kind of gave some of my initial impressions on it, but I have wrapped it up now at this point, and I will say it's really well done, man. It's as I told you, it's interesting. If you've played any of these games before, you know that kind of every episode of every one of these games is kind of built around five major decisions. And at the end of each episode, you get to see how your choices compare to other players playing the game. And that kind of cues you in on the fact that these are the five major decisions that are going to be used to really drive the narrative and branch the story going forward. Well, this introduces a new dynamic where, you know, you obviously make the five major decisions, and you can kind of pick them out there throughout the game as you're playing it, you know, if you've been in any of these games before. But what you don't realize is happening over the course of the game is in some of your lesser, more minor decisions where you're given four options and you're just having a dialogue with other characters, that the game is also tracking that as well. Because at the end of the game, you're also given a status update on the status of your relationship with five of the major side characters. And it shows you the three individual dialogue choices you made to cause that relationship to be moved in that direction. So as someone who had never played a Telltale game with this dynamic before, it was interesting to see that it's almost like they're trying to add importance to every choice you make rather than just those five big ones. So big thumbs up on this one. I cannot wait for the second installment, and it appears as if we are just going to get a plethora of new Telltale versions of classic Batman villains. They tease several different characters here, and it's going to be cool to see this studio's take on a lot of the different members of the Rogues Gallery.
Great. Can't wait to play it, although I'll have to wait to play it. I don't even think it's available on iOS yet. I tried to download it the other day, and all I found was the first season. But nevertheless, we'll see, and look forward to that. I have been watching. I watched one more episode of Luke Cage over the past week, and that was the fourth episode. And it's one that kind of tells you a little bit about the origins of Luke and how he gets his powers. And there are so many great nods to the comics in this episode, including you get to see him briefly wearing the old – a version of the old original Power Man costume from the 1970s. And I said to myself out loud, that is so awesome how they did that, because it is. It's really cool and clever and all that. Various little nods. He says Sweet Christmas in the episode, for God's sake, which is amazing. But overall, I got to say, Nick, didn't really love the episode. I thought it was disjointed. I didn't think it was edited very well. The transitions didn't work very well. And, you know, it was one of those deals where they committed a couple of, in my opinion, storytelling sins where if they had just had it from Luke's perspective and he's remembering these things, it's great. But there were times when they would flash to other characters in present day, like Misty and her detective colleague, and then it would go back to the flashback scenes. And that's – to me, that doesn't make sense as a transition. So overall, it wasn't bad. It just didn't work for me very well.
Man, I'm you know, a little disappointed to hear that, although I will agree that in my opinion anyway – some of the times that first season of Luke Cage, when it starts to stall out a bit, some of the episodes where it does that are some of the episodes where it's getting more into Luke's backstory. And I will tell you that there are several more of those in the back half of the season. Luckily, that one, if my memory is serving me well anyway, is pretty much the only one during the first half of the season. So I think you got another two, maybe three episodes, I can't really remember, of really good stuff coming your way before, in my opinion, the show takes a nosedive.
One thing I do like and find interesting about Luke Cage is how seemingly anyway more people know about him and his abilities than anybody else that we've seen thus far in the Netflix pantheon. Because when he escapes from this building, it seems like it would be pretty difficult for people to ignore the fact that this guy escaped unharmed from that situation. So that's gonna – I think that'll create an interesting dynamic maybe if they play off of it going forward.
Mm-hmm.
That's an end to my watch.
What have you thought of the music thus far, out of curiosity?
Oh, it's phenomenal. It's – to me, the music on this show is one of the best aspects. Mm. I think it's the best music of any of the Marvel Netflix shows. It puts you into the atmosphere of the episode really well.
Have you gotten the number Hail to the Chief yet?
I don't think so.
Okay. There's a rap number at one point in the club, and I think that was probably my favorite of the season that I really enjoyed. So
I really dug the I can't remember if it was the first episode or the second episode, had one of the guys from the old group, what was the group? Was it Tony? I can't remember, but he was really, really good doing like this like jazzy kind of tune. Mm-hmm. So I've just really enjoyed it. I think that's probably my favorite stuff on the show to this point has been the stuff that's taken place in the Cottonmouth Club. So,
yeah, well, hopefully you can finish the season of Luke Cage before next week's episode of the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. There are hurdles in the path of that being completed, but that's another story for another time. Let's move on to our weekly look at news and notes in the comic world, Nick. Let's move on to the rundown.
Welcome to the rundown. Do-do-do-do-do. Where we talk some comic news. Do-do-do-do-do. Welcome to the rundown. Do-do-do-do-do. Where we talk about movies too.
So we are going to start out with DC Comics here, but we're not going to start out with the DCEU corner. We're going to start out on the printed page because we have recently gotten a confirmation of the creative team behind the upcoming DC series Batman and the Signal. Now, no, for those of you who are novices or aren't following closely, it's not a story, a comic book about Batman and the Bat Signal and his changing the batteries on it or what have you. What this is a story about Batman and his newest sidekick, The Signal. Yes, The Signal. That is the code name they have come up with for Duke Thomas, who's a character that was created by Scott Snyder quite some time ago in his historic Batman run alongside Greg Capullo. This series is going to be co-written by Scott Snyder and a DC Writers Workshop alum, Tony Patrick. And Scott Snyder says he chose Tony Patrick for the book because he works with kids in Brooklyn as center that is not unlike the center in the series. So he was really passionate about the character. Very cool. The book will be illustrated by Cully Hamner, who has a very rich history in the comics medium, has done all kinds of great stuff. Nick, on a scale of 10 to 10, how excited are you for Batman and the Signal?
Wait a minute. There is no scale there. It's just the one number.
Tell me how excited you are for Batman and the Signal.
I'm so excited, Greg, that I just don't know how to contain myself. Duke Thomas has been – oh, I'm not going to crap on Duke Thomas. Duke Thomas has been fine, but was anybody really – clamoring for this Duke Thomas miniseries? And granted, at least it's a miniseries, right?
Oh, that's right. I forgot to mention that. It is a miniseries.
And only three issues, if I'm understanding things correctly. So at the very least, it's not like an ongoing that DC's going to shame us for not supporting if it gets canceled after you know, a relatively low number of issues. So at least it's just a little three-issue miniseries, and it's certainly there for those who are interested in such things, and I myself will pass.
Yeah, let's talk about the good and the bad here. The good, to me, I think the concept of we haven't even mentioned what the concept is. The concept is Duke Thomas, as the Signal, is going to be Batman's daytime operative. He is going to work in the daylight, in the bright lights of Gotham City to try to help people out of the shadows. I love that concept. I think that's a great concept. A concept that could be done with any of the other 450 Batman sidekicks that exist. But no knock on Duke, really. Duke has been a solid character, but the problem is I've never really invested in him. And
yeah,
I think that part of it is that he's not really different enough to me from the other Batman supporting characters.
I would agree. I would say that, you know, our beloved Scott Snyder is certainly – you know, every Batman creator kind of wants to leave their own stamp, and I'm all for us getting more stuff from a Scott Snyder created supporting character, but I think they chose the wrong one. I would much rather have a Harper Row led led title than this Duke Thomas title.
But I was about to say the same thing. I think Harper Row is much more unique and much different than the previous Batman supporting characters. And as I talk about a lot on the show, uniqueness and being different matters when you're trying to – that's why both of us, I think, like Damian a lot more than many other people do, because we like that he is different from the other Robins. Whereas right. to me, I never invested in Tim Drake because I never felt – he was different enough from the purpose that Dick had served before him. So, you know, I think this is, you know, that's a good thing there. The concept is great. The creative team is great, certainly. But we talked about Duke, and I've never been able to invest in him. And let's talk about this costume, Nick, because, I mean, he looks like Wolverine, let's be honest. He actually looks like the Dark Claw from the Amalgam Universe. I don't like this costume. I don't like the look of it, Nick. What are your thoughts?
I don't mind it. I don't love it. I get the fact that they wanted to go with a bright version, essentially, of the Batman costume to draw that parallel. But I don't know, man. It just is what it is. Is the
perhaps,
way.
Perhaps mustard yellow wasn't the best.
Yeah.
Approach. And also perhaps the thing that gets me is the cowl. The cowl looks just like Wolverine's cowl to me.
The yellow I can at least understand, because if you're going to go for a brighter version of the Batman costume, pretty much your mm-hmm. only other choice would be like a bright blue, which might look weird, or a just a plain white costume, which would definitely be
right.
definitely be strange. And with the enhanced usage of yellow in the Bat logo over the last
mm-hmm.
– during the Rebirth era, I guess it kind of makes sense that you would have yellow there, but – I agree with you. It is very Wolverine-esque. I just don't – it gives me no strong feelings either way. I'll put it that way. It's the old Cody line of costumes. How about that?
Ah, a blast from the past. But speaking of things that do give me strong feelings, Gal Gadot and her portrayal of Wonder Woman, who will be a part of the upcoming Justice League movie, which is, of course, part of the DC Extended Universe, which means that it's time, Nick, the DCEU Corner.
DCEU Corner.
And we've actually got some material this week for the DCEU Corner, because two bits of Justice League movie-related news came out this week.
Not so much news as reports.
Yes. Are you suggesting, Nick, that perhaps this could be baseless speculation?
Rumor and innuendo?
I like it. DCEU Corner, rumor and innuendo.
Now, granted, one of these is actually – I mean, I know there are some people who only think we should believe news about Justice League if it's directly reported by the studio. But this is from a dude who's in the film. So, like, I'm going to take one of these at least as confirmed – you know, fact.
Anyway. Not only an actor in the film, but the great Dr. Silas Stone is the character he's playing, but the great Joe Morton, who, of course, we know from Terminator 2 mm-hmm. Miles.
Miles Dyson.
Yes. Miles Dyson, yes. One of the great characters in Terminator. He recently did an interview. And he told IGN that he was called in for the reshoots that were recently – that are ongoing, I guess, with Joss Whedon. And he says that these reshoots were done to, quote, lighten up the film, end quote, after original director Zack Snyder's cut was deemed by the studio to be too dark. This is all according to Joe Morton. He says, the stuff that I had to do were really just small little bits and pieces, nothing necessarily having to do with tone. But I know that with Ray, referring to Ray Fisher, who plays Cyborg, there were some adjustments that they made in terms of the tone of that character. He said, I think what I heard was that there was a need from the studio to lighten up the film in a way that the film felt too dark. I don't know what that means in terms of how it actually got translated in terms of the reshoots, but that's what I heard. That's what I thought some of the reshoots were about. In fairness, Ray Fisher back in July at Comic-Con International described the reshoots as brief, if anything. So, Nick, what do you make of this?
Nothing unexpected. I think we all knew, or I have come to know over the last couple of months, since the Joss Whedon news came down, that there were going to be some fairly extensive reshoots on this thing. Probably not to the level of something like Rogue One, probably the last, film with notable extensive reshoots, but still enough to alter at least a good chunk of the movie. And I think with it being Joss Whedon, it only makes sense that those things that would be shot would naturally be lighter in tone. That's just more in his wheelhouse than the Zack Snyder approach to storytelling. So nothing real shocking here. I think it's a case of Joe Morton playing a supporting character and probably not being coached up on how to answer questions like this quite as much by DC, public relations and stuff. I think that little quote they threw in from Ray Fisher is pretty good indication that the leads of this film have been coached a little bit on how to sell it publicly.
Yeah, I pretty much would probably agree with that. I don't really have any strong feelings one way or the other. I think all of us figure that they're lightening the tone of this movie. I don't think that's a shock. What could come as a shock is the next news item, which is a report, that comes from Slash Films' Ben Pearson, claiming that a new ending to Justice League is being filmed as part of the Joss Whedon-led reshoots. These reported new scenes allegedly will change – gotta love the wording of this – will change an unconfirmed cliffhanger ending, and which would have had Steppenwolf, who is the villain of this movie, revealing himself to be an emissary to an unseen dark side to offer up that potential. Well, instead, this new ending is going to put more of a bow on this movie and pretty much give it a more definitive ending. And it says Steppenwolf's role in the film has also been increased in the reshoots. There are no sources cited in this, but Pearson says that part of these reshoots were to avoid a cliffhanger and to lighten the tone of the film so as to not end on a dour moment. And this is, of course, piggybacking off of what Joe Morton just recently said. No mention was made of how these reported changes could affect plans to include Darkseid in a sequel. Joss Whedon, however, previously stated his distaste for cliffhangers in the past, saying in 2013 that he found the ending of The Empire Strikes Back appalling at the time because the film didn't have an ending. So basically, my concern here, Nick, is on his own, Steppenwolf isn't a very compelling villain, in my opinion. Steppenwolf, to me, is only a compelling villain if he is the lead into Darkseid. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
is that just my comic book bias coming in?
No, I think it makes a lot of sense, and I think it shows one of the issues here is that I think this first film with Steppenwolf was always conceived anyway as the lead-in to a Darkseid film. Back in the days when this was first announced and Justice League 2 was going to follow like a year later or a year and a half later or whatever the original time frame was, I don't exactly remember. The problem is now with all the shakeup and turmoil in DC films in the wake of Batman v Superman and the wake of Suicide Squad, that second Justice League film has been delayed, perhaps indefinitely. And what you're left with is a position where Joss and Zack Snyder both and Jeff Johns and John Berg at DC Films are kind of damned if they do and damned if they don't. Because if they go ahead with having the Darkseid cliffhanger without a concrete plan in place for Justice League 2,
you end up with Green Lantern. Yeah.
You did that with Green Lantern. You have potential of setting up something you're not going to be able to pay off. On the other hand, you now have an instance where your first ever Justice League film is going to have Steppenwolf as the lead villain with potentially, hopefully not, but potentially no lead-in to Darkseid whatsoever ever occurring in the DC Extended Universe. And that is concerning because not to unfairly shit on Steppenwolf. I haven't read that many Steppenwolf stories in my time, to be fair. But if you're going to tell me that
not an A-lister,
that the first Justice League villain is going to be Steppenwolf, and it's not going to be a lead into Darkseid, then why did we not get you know, the Injustice League or the Legion of Doom or Lex Luthor.
Brainiac.
I was going to say Lex Luthor, and then I remembered Eisenberg, so let me rephrase. Brainiac or any other of the plethora of villains you could have gone with besides Steppenwolf. I don't know. This one's concerning, but ultimately I suppose the idea here is to make Justice League the best, most complete standalone film it can be. And if this helps achieve that, then here's hoping.
The biggest condemnation I can come out at DC with this is I think this is proof that if this is true – we don't know that this is true for the record. If this is true – again, we're speculating here, folks. If this is true, this is proof that Warner Brothers never learned any of the lessons from Green Lantern, because it was another case of putting the cart before their horse and assuming that a franchise would be successful. And thus, in your Green Lantern movie, you don't get Sinestro, really. You don't get any of the classic Green Lantern stories that you expect. You get a kind of hodgepodge, and you get the tease of, oh, but it's really just setting up Green Lantern 2, which never happened. And now you did a situation where you were so confident in your original vision of Justice League that you're just going to announce the sequel before a single Justice League movie has ever been made. Before a single movie in the DCEU has really been a smash hit. And when things don't go the way that you want them to and there are changes that come up, suddenly you're left with Steppenwolf as your Justice League. And maybe it'll be great. Maybe Steppenwolf will be awesome in the movie and it won't matter. But I'm just saying, as a comic book fan, like you, Nick, I'm kind of left scratching my head of like, well, maybe then you should have just held off on this concept, or just fucking done Darkseid in the first movie. Shit, I don't care. But just use a villain that is going to be memorable.
I think when this film and Justice League 2 were first announced, and when this film first went into the scripting process, you got to remember, Greg, they announced BVS at the Comic-Con of 2013, the same year that Man of Steel was released, a full 3 years before it ever hit theaters. And so, if I'm remembering correctly, they started hyping up Justice League and Justice League 2 at the 2015 Comic-Con, which was still a full 9 months out, or 8 to 9 months out from the release of BVS. And so, you're knee-deep into production on this film that you're envisioning as a two-part entity. And then BVS happens, and your entire perception of the status of your franchise is shaken. And I think BVS has shaken Warner Brothers and DC Films to such a degree that I don't know they've ever truly really recovered from it.
Yeah, they've been shaken, but not stirred, of course. but nevertheless, I agree with you, Nick. That very well could be the case, and I don't know. I'm hoping it's going to be great. I'm hoping Steppenwolf's going to rock and be awesome. But I'm really hoping this is not true, because I want to see that. I want to see just a hint of Darkseid.
Yeah, I mean, even if you see the tease of Darkseid, Justice League 2 is not on the slate of films they've announced. And we know now that Flashpoint is coming before we would ever get to that. So I don't know, man. I don't know. It's an interesting place to be in right now. I did find it interesting that it came out a couple weeks ago, and I know we haven't talked about this on the air, but apparently Flashpoint is being set up for 2019, if I remember correctly, or 2020, excuse me. So I think it's like third or fourth on the list of the next DC film. So as I kind of thought, it seems like they're fast-tracking that one, and that really seems to be the Justice League sequel and the direction it's going to take.
Very interesting. Yeah, I'm curious to see where that goes. And curiosity is a big aspect of my approach to the upcoming season of DC television on the CW. The Flash is a show that both of us love. I think most of our listeners out there love it as well. But it's a show that we've been a little bit critical of. Me probably a little bit more so than you.
Yeah.
In the last season, I feel like it's a show that kind of, in the eyes of a lot of people, a show that got stuck a little bit into a depression kind of feel for the last couple seasons, where the main character of Barry Allen, who in the first season was so chipper and optimistic and hopeful, went through trials and tribulations and, of course, reacted to those appropriately and was down in the dumps. But I think at a certain point, people got tired of seeing him be down in the dumps, and they wanted to see the Flash be the Flash again. And the good news for those people like myself and others is that it looks like we're going to get that in this upcoming season. The Flash last year, as people remember, did their own take on the Flashpoint comic book story by Geoff Johns. Well, this year they're going to do their version of another classic Geoff Johns comic book. This year we're going to get the Flash's version of Rebirth, which of course is the DC Universe-wide initiative that started with a Geoff Johns comic book that kind of brought a sense of hope, optimism, and joy and connectivity back to the DC Universe. Grant Gustin, who plays the Flash on the show, recently said in an interview with comicbook.com that the first episode of this season is going to be this show's take on Rebirth within its recent darker context. Here's the direct quote from Gustin. "It's almost like a fresh start for me as an actor this year. The first episode is called Reborn, and it's our take on Rebirth. And it gives me an opportunity to let go of all the weight that we've built up and have held on to. And there's even some lines that reflect that for Barry, that he's been able to cope and move on in a way he was never able to in the past. So it gives me an opportunity to kind of let go and have more of that kind of fun that we initially had in season one." So I am just stoked about this. The fourth season of The Flash premieres October 10th on the CW. This is exactly what I've been asking for, Nick. I am pumped. I really am excited about this. And they've won me over already. My fears and trepidations coming out of what I thought was probably, in my opinion, the weakest season to last year, have kind of been answered in a big way coming into this upcoming season, and I can't wait to see where it's going personally.
Yeah, I do. I wonder, just because Rebirth for the Flash could mean a couple of different things. Are we referring more to DC Rebirth or the Flash Rebirth? You know, because Geoff Johns did write that story a few years ago.
Good point.
So not really sure which of those they're going to pull from, but either way, I would imagine it's going to be something similar to Flashpoint, where they're going to pull the general concept, but not really the beat for beat story, because the TV version of Flashpoint pretty much did its own thing. So I'm interested to see which of those they're using as the inspiration. But yeah, I would tend to agree that I think it needs a little bit of a lighter tone, but I think you and I disagreed a little bit on the severity of the dark tone problem on The Flash last season.
Right. And again, I still love all the shows, but it's just something that I was concerned about the direction. Now, moving on to the other side of the CW universe, the anchor show, Arrow, which is coming off of one of its finest seasons in both of our opinions. They recently announced the casting for the guy who is presumed to be the main villain of the upcoming season. Kirk Acevedo has been cast as the television show's version of DC's comic book martial arts master, Richard Dragon. Now, he will be appearing as Ricardo Diaz, who is one of – it's kind of a modern take on Richard Dragon, because – longtime DC fans hear the name Richard Dragon and they think of something totally different. They think of the classic Kung Fu era martial arts superhero from the 70s. That was DC's 70s, 80s. It was DC's top martial arts master. He was the number one fighter hand to hand in the DCU, like above even Batman. And what we're getting is the Jeff Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino version of Richard Dragon. Here's a description of the character from Deadline. A hardened ex-con recently released from prison for crimes he didn't commit, Ricardo Diaz is bent on taking over Star City's criminal underworld. A master in hand-to-hand combat, honed by years of life on the street, Diaz has yet to make a foe he can't take down. Now, Lemire and Sorrentino used this version of Ricardo Diaz, who takes the name Richard Dragon after slaying the original, as the main villain of their last arc on the title. And it was awesome. Their reimagining of Richard Dragon for the 21st century in a way that made sense was brilliant. And the beauty of it is it also, because of Richard Dragon's comic book origins and his history, he spent time as a mentor to the Question. So it opens up the chance that we could see characters like Question appear and potentially the Huntress to return. So, Nick, your thoughts on Richard Dragon, the character? And, I mean, I don't think either one of us knows much about this actor, but your thoughts on Richard Dragon coming to Arrow in Season 6?
Don't know much about Richard Dragon, honestly, outside of the Lemire and Sorrentino run. I will point out that the Newsarama piece we're looking at says he will reportedly appear in a recurring arc. I don't know that that necessarily means he's going to be the big bad of the season. I haven't seen that anywhere, I mean, unless you're aware of something not.
Well, I've read it speculated on other websites. On CBR and a couple other places have speculated that he'll be the primary antagonist, if you will, this season.
Interesting. So. Maybe that's the case. Maybe it isn't. I don't really know. I will say, however, that the most intriguing part of this for me isn't even so much the Richard Dragon part as it is the Question part. Because if that was their way to bring into the Question to the DC universe or to the CW universe, I would be all for that. I think that's a character that would fit right in as a recurring character on Arrow, personally. So, interesting. Again, don't know much about the actor, but certainly willing to give pretty much anything Arrow does at this point the benefit of the doubt after an outstanding Season 5.
And the thing to keep in mind for people that don't know much about Richard Dragon is if they follow through on the promise of the character, you can expect some high-level martial arts action coming to Arrow in the very near future.
Well, Richard Dragon, you know, as we know, though, the comic book reputation of a character and their hand-to-hand fighting skills don't always translate directly to the screen. See Fist Iron, for an example.
That is correct. And if it goes by the comics, then Richard Dragon should be the first character that we've seen in the Arrowverse that can pretty much hand Oliver Queen his ass at a given moment. At least the first character since Prime Ra's al Ghul. So, going to be interesting to watch. Television, though, has its share of established villains in the comic book world, and in our opinions, one of the finest villains in all of comic book television was David Tennant's Kilgrave from Jessica Jones, and we received a report this week, Nick, that I'm sure does your heart fond, and that is that David Tennant will reprise his role as Kevin Kilgrave Thompson in Jessica Jones Season 2 on Netflix. This despite the fact that Kilgrave was seemingly killed by Jessica Jones at the end of Season 1. This show will premiere – the season will premiere on Netflix in 2018. Nick, your thoughts on this news?
Generally positive. Probably not as overwhelmingly positive as you would think. I would have to imagine – this will either be a, some sort of flashback in a flashback role, or perhaps, even more interestingly, some form of mental anguish that Jessica is suffering where she still sees and hears Kilgrave in places that he isn't. You know, possibly a new manifestation of the panic attacks we saw her having in Season 1, if you remember, where she was reciting the streets of her childhood neighborhood. I think having visions of Kilgrave appearing to her could be a very interesting way of continuing that theme of PTSD that's very much key to the Jessica Jones character and her story arc. So that's why I would say 95% positive, just because I am assuming that's the way it will go. On the off chance it's a legit resurrection, I am not a fan of that idea. I think they told that story so beautifully in Season 1 that I don't want them already going back on it and tampering with it quite yet. If you get 3, 4, 5 seasons in and you want to do that and you have a compelling and interesting way to do it, then fine. But right now, for Season 2, it's not time. It was done so well. There's no point in it.
It's very easy, Nick. They just send him to Tahiti.
I would think if they were going to resurrect him, they would ultimately reveal that he, like, commanded Jessica to have a false impression that he had killed her when, in fact – or she had killed him when, in fact, he had not been killed and escaped.
But I'm with you, Nick. I actually like the story the way it is. I think it was a fitting end to his character. So I'm not only hoping, but I'm betting that it's going to be flashbacks or, like you mentioned, the hallucinations. We're going to wrap things up with one final television-related story, and this is one that we don't have a whole lot of info on. We don't know who's right, who's wrong, but The Walking Dead creator Robert Kirkman and producers Gail Ann Hurd, Glenn Mazzara, and David Alpert have filed a lawsuit against AMC, the television station, to recover what they allege are profits from the show that are owed to them by the network. This is according to The Hollywood Reporter via Newsarama. This follows an ongoing lawsuit against AMC over similar matters by show co-creator and original showrunner Frank Darabont. Now, according to the complaint filed in the Los Angeles Superior Court, the basic issue is that AMC has found loopholes and weird ways to avoid paying the creators, the producers, the writers, etc., the share of the profits that they were originally promised. The allegation is that Walking Dead is so successful that the producers are not getting a measure of compensation that is commensurate with that success and according to what their contracts stipulate. Now, the reason we bring this up here is we don't know what the truth is. This is a legal matter, not for us to – it's really not for us to say. But we bring that up because I'm interested, Nick, in – if you think this could have any ramifications on the show going forward.
I would say no, because the important thing to note here is that Frank Darabont, the original showrunner for season one of the show, has a very similar lawsuit in the works right now with AMC that is currently being litigated. So I would say they push through that. I understand that Kirkman is a little bit different. He's kind of been a true creative partner throughout the entire process for AMC. So that one's a little bit concerning. But I don't think anyone is – I don't think that anyone is irreplaceable at this point outside of perhaps Robert Kirkman. To give a little bit more detail, Greg, on what's actually going on here, allegedly AMC has been withholding profits from Kirkman and the other named producers through a complicated scheme that saw AMC – see, AMC and AMC Studios are technically two separate entities. And basically what happened is they are alleging that AMC, the network, was paying AMC Studios less than full market value for the production of the show, which gave AMC leftover cash that they were then pocketing, allegedly. Basically getting the show produced at a lower rate than it would cost them to have it produced by an external production company and them not sharing those savings with the producers. That appears to be the crux of the issue.
Yeah, so we'll see how it turns out once it goes through the all the legal processes that it must go through. And my hope is that it doesn't really affect the show because I'm enjoying it. I hope the show continues to be successful and that they can work out their issues. But certainly – creators need to be paid. We've seen this issue in comics. It's an issue in television. It's an issue in film. It's an issue in wrestling. The talent needs to be paid, and hopefully that will be the case. If it is chosen to be legally appropriate. So with that being said, that wraps up the rundown. That wraps up my politically correct trying to toe the fence there on the legal issue. That wraps up the show for this week. We hope you enjoyed it. We've got a countdown coming next week in honor of the debut of Netflix's The Defenders. We are going to count down our top five episodes of the Marvel Netflix universe. This encompasses Daredevil seasons 1 and 2, Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, and Iron Fist. So that should be fun, right, Nick?
Oh, yeah, definitely should be. I'll be interested to see how your list turns out being because, like I said, you don't have a complete picture. But I think with only four – you know, your four episodes of Luke Cage in, honestly, you're probably only three episodes away from being able to have the pool you would want to pull a top five from. But then again, perhaps one day when you see the back half of Luke Cage and the entire season of Iron Fist, you will have a higher opinion on those two things than I do. But – you know, we will see. I can tell you that's where all five of my episodes will be coming from, is from the first half of Luke Cage, both seasons of Daredevil and Jessica Jones.
I think the big question everybody has to ask right now as we wait for next week is just how many Jessica Jones episodes will make your top five, Nick? That's the big question. Is it going to be five is the question.
It's possible. I wouldn't rule it out. I got to go back and take a look at it. off the top of my head, I think 3 is the over-under probably.
Going to be an interesting countdown, my friend. And then, oh my gosh, Nick, a week after that, I believe that's when we're going to be dropping the ultimate bomb on the public. That is when we're going to be unveiling Comic Book Theater. That is when we're going to be unveiling our version of Watchmen.
That is correct. You and I actually have a little bit of reshoots to do that we need to knock out for that project here pretty soon so that it'll make its release date on time, Greg. We're pushing up against the studio set release date, and you know that's always a problem. So, well, yeah, you're absolutely right. The very last day of August is currently slated to see the release of Comic Book Theater Watchmen, so very much looking forward to that.
Much like TNT at 11 p.m. on a Monday night during the late 90s, we're desperately out of time. So we do need to get on that. But before we go, I want to ask you real quick, Nick, favorite Roddy Piper moment?
Oh, of all time?
Mm-hmm.
Mine's not a very good answer because it's colored by my childhood and my fandom, but like Roddy Piper was almost like the perfect third guy in that Hogan Andre segment. The with the ripping off of the shirt and Piper's "You're bleeding" line, and like that whole deal was so perfectly done by Piper. And you know, Piper is so well known for screaming and ranting and raving and being, you know, the hot Scott and all that stuff. And him turning it down a notch for that promo to sell the seriousness of what had just happened, I thought was always just the icing on the cake, so to speak, of that segment. And so that would be mine, although I admit it's not the best representation of Roddy Piper being the focal point, you know?
That's a great pick, though, because that to me, that illustrates his diversity as a performer, because you're completely right about that he was almost the glue in that segment, because he made it seem like it was real, like it meant something.
Right, right.
That your bleeding line, which was completely improv'd, was really smart. I think my choice for favorite Piper moment, and there are so many that I could choose from, but the one that I always think back to is the promo on Nitro when he revealed that Eric Bischoff was the mole that was helping the NWO out.
Oh, spoilers, Greg. I'm currently working my way through 1996 WCW.
Oh, well, sorry, Nick, but sorry for these 20-year later spoilers, but that to me, that promo is masterful. It was a great promo. It was one of the last great Piper moments in his career, and he had so many great ones at the WWF before that, but this was his pinnacle in WCW. Great stuff, an amazing segment, and Piper had that ability at his best to make you hold on to every single word that he was saying and believe that it was real. And he was a great performer. So anyway, folks, we'll wrap up on that note, and I leave you with one final thought, Jerry Springer style. And my final thought is this: just when you think you have all the answers, I change the questions. Are you gonna give me fucking anything on this show, or why are we even here?
Listen up, slap dick. Let me answer the fucking question. Give me a minute. Well, Klondike Bill told me that if he ever came across a woman who was extremely clean and well kept, he would tell her to put on a pair of sweatpants and a sweatshirt, go take a 2-mile jog, and then come back and see him when she was done.
Thank you.